Radio Mysterios is now recording. This is our second. It's not really remote. I mean, it's from my place. Fade that down to nothing. Uh-oh, that's Nick in the background yawning. He's already bored. Play, you piece of poop. It doesn't want to play the intro. Oh, it's trying to play it off my phone. That's not going to help anybody. How about that?
Greetings, my friend. We are all interested in the future, for that is where you and I are going to spend the rest of our lives. And remember, my friend, future events such as these will affect you in the future. You are interested in the unknown, the mysterious, the unexplainable. That is why you are here. And now, for the first time, we are bringing to you the full story of what happened on that fateful day. We are giving you all the evidence based only on the secret testimony of the miserable souls who survived this terrifying ordeal. The incidents, the places. My friend, we cannot keep this a secret any longer. Let us punish the guilty. Let us reward the innocent. My friend, can your heart stand the shocking facts about
Radio Mysterioso.
Let me turn that down. There's not too much delay on this, but it's still driving me nuts, so we're just going to do it without being able to monitor ourselves. Nick's here. He called me yesterday. Oh, no, you messaged me on Friday.
That's right, I did. Yeah. Just in town for a day to do a TV shoot and thought, why not hang out with good friend Greg and see what's going on?
Okay, let me get all the gains up here. Maybe I'll point it more at Nick. How about that? Is that a little bit better? I don't know.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Yes. Well, it's not like being in a studio, but maybe I can get some reports from people on Facebook or whatever, telling us if the audio quality is good enough.
Quality.
Yes. Can people actually hear us? Here, let me do the put the input for the microphone up quite loud. There we go. Now that should be fine. Let's see the level going out. That's an acceptable level, and it looks good on the recorder. So we're cool. Yeah, Nick messaged me and said, I'll be in L.A. on Sunday. So you were here interviewing for some TV show, which you have signed a non-disclosure you can't talk about. And I was going to take Nick around to some places today. He said, let's just go back to your place and just sit around and drink beer. So that's what we did. And we went and got something to eat. Nick just... Every time I'm on, I say, every time Nick's on, I say, hey, Nick just released another book. What? As Walter said, he will be writing one as we do the show live. He'll be writing a book in the background.
Well, it's funny you should mention that.
Yeah. Well, the I talked to Nick about this today. We were at the pub. And it shouldn't surprise anybody that Nick writes so many books, because that's what he does for a living. You know, if everything you did at your work was put out in front of the public, you'd have as many books as Nick does. So he's that's his job. What's the new book, Nick?
The new book's called The Pyramids and the Pentagon, and it's basically a study of how and why government agencies, going back to the 40s, have analysed and studied everything, sort of ancient artifacts, things like the Ark of the Covenant, Noah's Ark, the Dead Sea Scrolls, And it sounds like a really weird and bizarre story until the more you dig into it and you find that government agencies have been interested in all these different things over the years, and for a lot of varied and weird reasons as well. You know, part of it is just down to the fact that governments have a lot of money and they throw a lot of that money at weird little think tanks. But equally, there's sort of some evidence that they were looking into the mysteries of the past to try and determine if there was, like, advanced technologies that could be almost, like, weaponized for the present, if you like.
Did any of that turn into anything, or was it just kind of a bunch of dead ends?
Well, I don't know if so much it was dead ends, but
You're going to open the beer here.
There you go. And that's not, I think, as much it was dead ends, but it was more along the lines of... If there's even a remote possibility of us finding something, well, let's throw 50 grand here, or let's throw 30 grand there. You know, it's back in the 50s. I mean, one example was that one of the most bizarre things I found was that in the 50s onwards, the elements of the military had opened files on some of the key researchers who were looking at the idea that the pyramids in Egypt and also the similar pyramids in Central and South America were built via levitation or anti-gravity in simple terms. Now, you know, a lot of people have talked about this theory. To find actually, through the Freedom of Information Act, government files on the subject, that sort of really took things to another level. But it's clear that the reason for the research wasn't to sort of further our knowledge of archaeology, history or whatever, but it was done to because the military was clearly interested in the technology, if there was a technology involved. For example, the groups that were looking at the anti-gravity angle were all sort of radical advanced weapons research divisions, and I think that tells us a lot as to why that was done. But again, it doesn't mean that's how they were definitely built, nor does it mean the government is sitting on that proof. It means that government agencies spend a hell of a lot of time researching weird stuff, even if there's like even just a small chance it's going to pan out.
So they didn't really find anything except for... Well, what did they find? I mean, what are these... these are FOIA reports you found?
Yeah.
What's one where somebody seemed really interested in something that might turn into a technology that could be weaponized or whatever you're going to do with it?
Well, yeah, I mean, probably the most... The most visual one, at least, in terms of documentation, is the CIA's file on Noah's Ark, of which they've released about 70 pages through the Freedom of Information Act. And within the CIA, it's not called Noah's Ark. It's called the Ararat Anomaly. Ararat being Mount Ararat, where supposedly, in the biblical version of, you know, this sort of great flood in the past, where Noah's Ark supposedly came to land. And the story goes back to 1949 when a US Air Force spy plane was flying over Turkey towards the border of the Soviet Union to photograph a new Soviet military base that was being set up. And they used Mount Ararat as kind of like a guiding point to fly over. And as they literally passed the peak of Mount Ararat, one of the crew reported seeing what looked like about a 300-foot long wing sticking out of the ice. So they quickly swung the aircraft around, photographed it, and as they did so, they found another one on another part of the mountain, so they photographed that.
What, sticking out of glaciers?
Yeah, literally. And some of those pictures have now been declassified, and actually reproduced one in the book. When they got back to base, they explained what had happened, that they got kind of bypassed on the way to doing the original mission. These photographs were subsequently shared with the CIA, the Defense Intelligence Agency, and various other arms of the military and the intelligence community. And the CIA's file extends, you know, across decades. One of the most interesting things is an entry, and this demonstrates the sheer extent to which the CIA was interested, from 1975, where there was a guy who got a new book out in that year about Noah's Ark, and he...
That search for Noah's Ark in the font of the gods cover, like Chariots of the Gods.
Exactly the one. Yeah. And he gave a presentation at a shopping mall in D.C. And there are actually references in the file to how people from the CIA's Science and Technology Division were ordered to go out in plain clothes and attend the lecture
and report back on what was described in the files as, quote, the Ark problem. And that's an actual quote from the file. So it's kind of like, what would be considered a problem in terms of Noah's Ark for the CIA.
Yeah.
And one of the agencies, or so I should say projects that the files were shared with, was a US Air Force/military project called Project Moondust. Project Moondust is a project with UFO overtones to it, which back in the early 60s onwards, their job or their mandate was to sort of capture, you know, things like Soviet satellites that had crashed or rocket debris and analyze it to see how it compared to US technology. And they were copied on all the files on Noah's Ark. And what the files reflect is one of the reasons for looking into this was the idea, could it be that Noah's Ark was actually some sort of ancient spacecraft rather than a huge boat filled with 2x2 animals? Could it have been like a huge space ark filled with animal DNA?
The government seriously considered this.
There were people, because
of that lecture.
Yes. Well, but the thing to remember, what you have to remember is that people in government are like us. They're normal human beings. And some people have a belief in this and some people have a belief in that. Just because they're in government doesn't mean they're not swayed by belief systems. And so all these different theories were looked into. And the CIA still has an ongoing file on this Ararat anomaly. And certain of the files are still classified, some in the interest of national security. What's really interesting, a lot of people...
Is Ararat near the border with Russia?
Yes, the former Soviet Union.
Well, that might make a difference.
Well, you see, one of the theories is that maybe the CIA subtly promoted the idea they were interested in Noah's Ark to covertly spy on what the Russians were doing. You know, so it may have been exploiting a mystery to do something else. One of the most interesting things, a lot of people are probably aware of this story about how back in the early 1960s, Senator Barry Goldwater approached General Curtis LeMay of the US Air Force and said he wanted to know what was going on at Wright-Patterson. Did they really have alien bodies, you know, deep under the base? And if so, could he see them? And supposedly LeMay basically said, not just no, but hell no, go away.
Go away, you little bleeder.
Exactly. But what's interesting is in the files on the CIA's files on Noah's Ark, they talk about Goldwater approaching them. And he said, almost exact words were, if you tell me to go to the devil, I'll know what to do. So it was almost like he was anticipating a similar response to what he got to LeMay when he was trying to find out about Noah's Ark. Mm. So, you know, there's a lot of weird...
So Barry Goldwater, he was a UFO... He was basically an anomalies researcher peppering the government for files on UFOs, Noah's Ark, and other things?
Yeah, exactly. And but he also anticipated every time after LeMay being told...
Too bad
to
he's
go
such
to
a right-wing wacko. I would have voted for him. Well, I wasn't old enough to vote then, obviously, but...
There's a lot of weird stuff. But I point out to people, you know, this is an important thing to remember, is because the government's investigating Noah's Ark doesn't mean it's found some profound secret. It means money's being thrown in a certain direction and different people and different agencies have their own personal views, which they were able to pursue to a degree personally and also officially because they got funding. You know, does that mean they found a crashed UFO or an old boat or nothing at all? You know, that's the important thing. We just really don't know the answer.
Yeah. I just thought of the stupid paranormal radio host question, which I guess would be, do you think, Nick, that they're doing this now, right as we speak, in this day and age? Nick Redfern, what? Author of the new book, The Pyramids of the Pentagon?
one of the weirdest things...
Vaguely serious about that question, I guess.
One of the things that I did found is that, you know, some of these files are ongoing. I mean, the latest...
Because you did say ongoing.
Yeah, the latest declassified entry in the CIA's file on this thing that's known as the Ararat anomaly is 1995, which talks about... what it talks about is a company that wanted the CIA to get involved because...
Unfortunately, you have to look this way when you... It's a very directional microphone.
Okay. It basically talks about how somebody had approached the CIA and said, we're a TV company and we've heard that you have a technology that allows satellites to see through thick layers of ice. Yeah. And the CIA freaked out, you know, that is this something that somebody in the Pentagon has developed and a leak has developed? So they even looked into this. Now, in terms of other files, I will be the first to admit that a lot of these investigations into sort of ancient relics, ancient artifacts, began in the 40s. I mean, the earliest one was a quest to decipher a Dead Sea Scroll that the CIA got their hands on that never reached the official collection that's now on public display.
What, was it like an extra one that was found somewhere else?
No, it was actually brought into the CIA office in Damascus by this sort of Bedouin-type character in flowing robes who said he wanted somebody to analyse it. And he handed it over to a man named Miles Copeland, who was a senior CIA operative, who was also actually the father of
Stuart Copeland and Miles Copeland, the founder of IRS Records.
Yes, exactly. And but Miles Copeland Sr. Basically took possession of this material, and it was analysed within the CIA. And this particular scroll has never surfaced. But it was supposedly all related to the Book of Daniel and prophecies and weird dreams. And, you know, the CIA has had a lot of interest in all that sort of stuff. But this is the 40s. The Noah's Ark thing kicked off in the 50s. It does seem there was a far greater degree of all this research into ancient relics in that era.
Yeah, wasn't the Dead Sea Scrolls found in like 1947?
Yeah, 47. Same year as Roswell, yes. Kenneth Arnold, National Security Act and the establishment of the CIA and the death of Aleister Crowley.
Exactly, yes.
All 47.
Yeah.
And there was a bad winter in England as well, by the way.
Oh, Collis said that Barry Goldwater isn't whacked out as most of the neocons today. Neocons are today. Carlos, I totally agree with you. It was just people were so radical then, he seemed so right-wing. No, he was actually pretty level-headed about most stuff. He just happened to be on the conservative side of stuff. Anyway, it has nothing to do with what Nick was talking
actually,
about.
Actually, I have an interesting question. How is it that water can actually be gold?
I don't know. I think, wasn't that an old Jewish name? Goldwasser or something like that? It's a European name, I think.
I've seen clear water, blue water, and dirty water. I've never seen gold water.
Well, they used to have, in the 60s, I think you can still buy these, like collectors have them. Nixon's campaign actually had was it Nixon? He wasn't running. Yeah. God, who was it? McGovern, somebody. Whoever he was running against for the nomination had a button that said, "In your heart, you know he's right." And the people that didn't like Goldwater, the liberals, had buttons that said, "In your guts, you know he's nuts."
But yeah, I mean, there's a lot of weird stuff going on, as I said, with there were two people in particular that the government opened files on, which I got again through the Freedom of Information Act, who've been looking into the idea that the pyramids of Egypt were built and elsewhere with some sort of anti-gravity or levitation technology. Two of the people who had files opened on them, one was Maurice Jessop, who wrote a book called The Case for the UFO, and the other one was Dr. Bruce Cathy, who wrote a book called Harmonic 33 and Harmonic 695, which looked at the idea of some sort of advanced technology used to lift these ancient stones. Now, if you go back and look into all cultures that have these massive structures, whether the pyramids in Egypt, South America, Central America, Stonehenge in Britain, ancient Rome, ancient Greece, a lot of them talk about these huge stones being lifted by what was described, this sounds weird when I first say it, but as by music or to the sound of musical instruments and tunes and things like this. And one of the things, that I was able to get through the Freedom of Information Act was files from the military talking about how they were researching acoustic technology, the idea of applying directed acoustic waves, if you like, and raising small objects within the this sort of controlled acoustic region, if you like.
Okay, how like they levitate frogs now, but that's with the magnetic
energy. I mean, the principle is kind of similar. But to see the military was doing it, and then you find that the divisions that were speaking with Maurice Jessop actually got files where they were talked about interviewing him, was actually a special weapons division within the Navy. So again, I think this is evidence that people within the military were mandated with, you know, just follow every clue, just follow every lead and see if we can really come up with some radical weaponry. And one of the things they did was to look into the mysteries of the past to see if they could use it in the present.
Now, I'm just going to leave the microphone there and see if I can hear myself pretty well.
And I forgot what I was going to say.
Golden water. Yeah, golden water. There's a, and I brought this up, I think, a couple weeks ago in another show. There was a passage in one of William Burroughs' books where he talks about these generals researching psychic things, and he's saying they don't give a damn about what's real and what's not. They just want to know what works.
No, that's actually a really good quote, and that's true. You know, I mean, with the best will in the world, those of us in the sort of paranormal research community, you know, we're limited by budgets, wages, income, everything else, you know, as to what we can do. You know, if you're a think tank of, say, 10 people in the Pentagon, and you're tasked with looking into whether or not the pyramids were built via levitation, you're going to get the benefit of maybe, you know, a $200 grant or whatever, or of funding to look into this. And so, you know, that
$200?
$200,000.
Oh, okay. I want $200. I want $200,000 to look into
that
it.
That might buy a couple of books about the pyramids.
Yeah, at this point.
Yeah. So, yeah, I think, you know, it is a case of governments covering all bases. But what often happens is that people, even within conspiracy fields, make the conclusion that if the government's investigating in something, that means they've discovered some huge secret about it. That actually isn't always the case. Sometimes it really is just, well, let's see, you know, let's throw some money in this direction, let's do some investigations, and let's see how much sticks. And if nothing sticks, they move on to something else. But the mere fact that they've looked into it years later provokes, you know, a lot of significant thoughts about, well, why was that going on, you know?
Yeah. What else I was going to ask you about? When I heard Nick was coming, I haven't seen his book, and two, I didn't write anything down because usually we just talk. The funny thing is, we were looking through these Bill Moore files this afternoon, and we will talk about the synchronicities of this trip here in a second. we're looking through these files I got from Bill Moore, which I haven't looked at really until Nick got here today, and we found one on research into acoustic lifting of rocks.
Mm-hmm.
And it's saying that some guy had gone to Tibet in the 1950s and seen monks, or the 40s or 30s, and seen monks doing this with, like, trumpets and drums and things, mm-hmm. building temples by levitating rocks, which also, and if Walter was here, he'd bring up the Lees Kalnin, the guy mm-hmm. from Florida yeah. that built this what's it called, the coral castle,
yeah.
out of giant coral blocks weighing many tons apiece. And that he would never tell anybody how he did it. So there were all these ideas that he, you know, had some kind of, he did it through some kind of, you know, magical powers or something like that.
Terrible levitators.
Yes. What levitators?
Terrible levitators.
Yes, terrible.
From the stars.
Yes. So, I don't know. Maybe, are there any big books, like, you know, any kind of research books on acoustic levitation?
No. Really in the public domain. There are people who've looked into it in the kind of the way I have, in terms of interpreting, you know, these ancient legends of magical music and the tune of a flute lifting, you know, the rocks, which sounds bizarre. And
it sounds,
you know,
like hippie crap.
And it's certainly, nobody should be interpreting this literally. But if you interpret it from the perspective that all these legends talk about sound raising the stones, that's a very different thing. For example, in England, where I'm originally from, you know, there's a legend
You're
about
from England?
Afraid so. There's a legend of Stonehenge,
yeah.
that supposedly the fabled magician Merlin raised the stones of Stonehenge to a magical musical tune. You know, and when these nations are sort of separated by thousands of miles and sometimes centuries, and yet they all have these weird stories which seem to follow a similar path. Even I, you know, have to wonder if there was some sort of technology in the hands of the ancients that wasn't like car engines, you know, combustion or atomic energy, but a far, almost like a spiritual energy that, you know, that didn't rely so much on machinery and technology, but that we've lost, but that ancient man harnessed, and, you know, we're trying to rediscover, if you like.
Yeah.
And I actually do really think there could be something to this, you know, the idea of that that's how at least part of this went on, maybe.
Acoustic levitation or yeah. Battle of Jericho with all the shouting and the walls come down.
Yeah, that's right. You know, the trumpets bringing down the walls of yeah. Jericho, you know, that's, what's the much, is there much difference between,
you know, raising massive blocks to bringing them down if it's the same basic technology.
Mm-hmm. When Nick, when Nick got to the hotel at that he's staying at here in L.A., he said the guy at the front desk, what was his name?
Yeah, he had a name badge. He was the guy, the clerk on the front desk at the Radisson. I forget the name of the road, but his name's Charles Fort. And he's... His name is on his badge, and if you want to go there, you can see it. I said to him, do you know there's a famous Charles Fort? And he did, so he clearly, you know, he knew the stories of Charles Fort. But I just thought it was kind of odd that I was in town to do a paranormal TV show. I was meeting up with Greg to do the radio show. I stay at this hotel, and the guy on the desk is Charles Fort, which is like one of those sort of just totally bizarre things that kind of happens in this field now and again. And of course, as Greg pointed out, you know, we're gonna have me on tonight talking about the pyramids. Greg opens these Bill Moore files for the first time ever and opens to a page about acoustic levitation and the pyramids. You know, it's kind of like I don't know what it's like, but it's something weird.
Yeah, if Paul Kimball is listening, he'd be excited and not very surprised. Mm. We were walking over to the pub to have something to eat, and somebody had scratched the name Nick into the concrete.
Yeah,
I just happened to look down when I saw it. It's like, oh, Nick. Mm. Do you want to say what room you're in?
Oh, yeah, I'm in 1163, which, of course, 1163 was when Kennedy got assassinated, and that's one of my other big areas of interest, so... Overall, this has sort of been a
living
weird,
in Dallas.
Living in Dallas, yeah, exactly. I live in Dallas, so it's been kind of a fun, highly appropriate 14 weekend. And I guess it's only 8 o'clock here, so there's plenty of time for plenty of more 14 weirdness.
Yeah, we're gonna see what happens when we go over to the Griffiths Observatory here.
We're gonna get inundated in gold water.
Yes, Carlos says gold. Most of these Ashkenazic names like Goldwater, Goldwasser were simply Germanic sounding names that were similar sounding to the Yiddish surnames. Okay, I'll accept that. Obviously, Carlos knows more about it than we do, and thank you.
Yeah, all I know about Goldwater was that he basically tried to see the alien bodies and he was told to...
Piss off.
Go away from seeing the alien bodies. No, you won't see those aliens.
What else were we cracking up about? We don't have to talk about UFOs.
Oh, God. The FBI file on Truman Bethurum.
And George Hunt Williamson.
George Hunt Williamson. Truman Bethurum's story of this...
Maybe you can find the actual quote in there.
Truman Bethurum's story is one of my favorite ones. He wrote a number of books, but his most famous book deals with the alleged meetings with this hot alien space babe named Aura Raines, who came from the planet Clarion, and who he described Aura Raines as being tops in shapeliness and beauty.
Yes.
And he kept going on about her
which
outfit, which basically he described as fitting so snugly. And he was a bit of a loner type character and a fantasist. But I actually think
he was a lecherous loner.
Well, he was, but I think he may well have had some real experiences, but in kind of like a hypnagogic state where he was having a lot of weird stuff going on in his life with his marriage, and I think he may well have sort of invoked some sort of imagery in his mind that may become externalized. He wanted a fantasy woman, if you like, and I think she could have come to life in sort of a tulpa hypnagogic state. But what's interesting...
That, and apparently he liked dominating women.
Yeah.
The commander was Aura Raines.
Yeah, that's actually a very good psychological point. And a lot of people don't realize that... His third wife, he got married three times.
I didn't realize he was married three times.
He was married three times. His third wife, her initials were AR, the same as Aura Raines.
Oh,
so there's a kind of like a little psychological thing going on. But just this afternoon when we're going through the Bill Moore files, we found George Hunt Williamson's, one of the contactees, we found his FBI file, which talks about significantly about Truman Bethurum. And the FBI even described this alien space woman, Aura Raines, as, quote, a ravishing woman commandant in the Nevada desert from outer space. You know, so even the FBI kind of got infected by this sort of meme, if you like, of this
ravishing is an adjective we have to bring back.
Yeah, ravishing woman commandant. So that's how the FBI actually describe this purported space woman in their official files.
Ilsa She-Wolf of the space people. What? Oh, you didn't read about their fight.
Oh yeah, there's also references in there to Truman Bethlehem and George Hunt Williamson arguing over the price, the entrance receipts. Fee. At a conference they were both planning to speak at, and who was going to get the most door money from the lectures. And apparently it all got pretty hectic and contentious and almost fists were flying, I think. So, which is what ufology is about and should be about. So.
Yes. Well, I did have that wonderful story when Ray Stanford was on. He did talk about Williamson coming into the room when he was... when he was staying at Williamson's house when he was like 17 or something, and Williamson trying to molest him.
God. And doesn't Ray Stanford do a good impression of...
Ray Stanford does the only impression of George Adamski.
And it's a good one, isn't it?
It's very good. I mean, if you could imagine what George Adamski sounded like, it's a good one.
Okay.
If you want to listen to that program, I think he actually does it on the program. What did he say? About the saucer crap thing. Dutman Roosevelt, he repealed the prohibition. If it wasn't for him, I don't have to get into all this saucer crap.
Yeah, I mean, for me, that kind of era is probably my favorite era, because not necessarily in terms of the data of what UFOs are, but in terms of the pop culture of it just being a fun era, you know. It's kind of like
we're nostalgic for a period we didn't even live through.
No, I mean, I wasn't even born in the 1950s. I wasn't born until 1964. You know, it's like one of these things, or the end of 64. You know, the contactee movement, its golden age, was long over even by then. But you know, for me, they were such characters, and they were funny, and they were engaging, and they were interesting. You know, regardless of whether they were truthful or whether they were, as some people think, Russian spies, American agents trying to discredit the subjects, if they'd had hypnagogic experiences, you know, altered states through LSD or whatever. You know, we don't know. But the thing is, they kind of raise the flying saucer pop culture aspect of the subject to, like, really engaging, interesting levels, regardless of what you think of them, you know. And I think... for me, the people in the subject back then were as interesting, if not more so, than what they were actually saying.
Yeah, I think Mosley says that too. And he did live through that period, so he knows.
Mm-hmm.
And he interviewed and talked to many of those people. You can do that right in the microphone, Nick.
Oh, okay.
It's that kind of a show. I don't know. I think there's a lot of good characters. Remember Johan Off Gran? Remember that guy?
Yeah. Well, I think there's...
And Yahweh Ben Yahweh, and the guy that could make UFOs appear on command, but basically they were balloons somebody had let up, like, you know, a mile away somewhere.
Well, that's what makes the whole thing so interesting. Or, like, you know, Buck Nelson selling...
Venusian dog hair,
which happened to, interestingly enough, actually matched the hair on his own pet dog. You know?
Oh, really? I thought he was using that fake. He had pink Venusian dog hair.
Well, now some of it apparently did match his own poor little dog, where he used to obviously pluck the hairs out and sell it. You know, his poor little dog's like, oh God, I've got to go through this again, you know. And
well, he's in that one of my favorite UFO culture pictures ever. It's that he's holding a science at saucer convention and the S is backwards. In his overalls, which is even better.
Did he have a banjo?
He should have a banjo and crossed eyes and crooked teeth and, you know.
A purdy mouth.
Yeah. But Buck Nelson says, you got a purdy mouth for a Venusian.
But yeah, I mean, I think for me that whole era was... I mean, a lot of people write the contactees off as just bullshitters and, you know, just fantasies. The more you look into their stories, they're not. I really do think it's a combination of genuine incidents, but in altered states, identical pretty much to experiences that people have had out in desert and remote locations for thousands of years, whether it's communing with gods, fairies, goblins, sprites, djinn, space brothers, greys. It's all, you know, Aleister Crowley and Lamb. It's all the same thing, but in a different motif. And I do, there's actually, I think...
Nick is taking the words in my brain and speaking them out.
Yes, I'm babbling in channeled, psychically possessed...
Well, I people have asked me about that, you know, on shows and things like that, too, and I basically said the same thing for many years. I think that there was, for some of them, not all of them, there was a precipitating, some sort of precipitating event, either something they saw, or they just saw a UFO somewhere, or they had an altered state experience, and then that made it okay for them to continue with that. There are people that I think totally made it up, like who? I think Turin Bethram may have totally... Well,
no, I don't think Bethram... The more you dig into his story, I think... Orfeo Angelucci, if you read...
Orfeo, I think, actually did have some some sort of experience that he thought came from outside of him and he thought were space people.
Well, what's really weird about his story is that if you read his book...
And it may have happened.
Yeah.
I mean, don't know about literally happened.
Well, something happened to him, but what's more interesting than the experience, his sort of core encounter, is in his book... He talks about how in 1953, bear in mind this was the era when the CIA was really involved in the whole MK Ultra mind control thing. He talks about being invited by this mysterious character called Adam to discuss his UFO encounters. And Adam basically makes Orfeo drink this weird liquid. Within 30 minutes or so, Angelucci starts to feel weird, spaced out. And the glass on the table mutates into this little ballet dancer who starts dancing. The room starts to shake and move. And it's pretty clear he's under some sort of psychedelic influence.
Well, either he is looking into the literature from way back where people do take things, drink things, and enter into an altered state.
But again, if you look at the time frame, what he also talks about, he said that this actually took... place in a California diner out of the middle of nowhere.
Oh, yes.
But he said that on the table next to them were two military guys sat in uniform, intently watching the whole experience, which makes it sound to me that somebody had dosed him up to get information on his experience to try and determine if it was real or not, or possibly to influence the saucer scene by instilling altered state experiences, because this was the time of the Robertson panel, which is recommending watching UFO groups and influencing opinions, etc. You have to wonder if some of these people that the government was worried about, who were attracting big audiences, if they tried to meddle with and influence their experiences in some respect.
Possibly. If somebody told me that's BS and I think it's silly and I don't know why you would think such a thing and you've made this up or read too much into it, I would disagree with them. Yeah. In this case, listening to you say that, I'm because of my nature, I'm thinking, no, he just wanted to make himself sound important by saying there were military people sitting at the next table. But I do not know. Mm-hmm. I was not there. And I think for the most part, Adamski's stuff, to me, if there's any truth to it, there may be like 5 or 10%.
Well, that's true.
Truth what he thought was true.
Yeah. But I think what happens, and I really do believe this, is that, this whole angle of belief creating reality... is that the more people who believed in the Space Brothers and these communal experiences in the desert, it may have provoked like a tulpa type of externalized fantasy becoming reality and giving birth to sort of a quasi-independent vague life form that, manifested for these people. I really do think that can happen.
I think it can possibly happen. I've never seen it happen. I've seen many, many reports of it. If you read Alexander David Neal's stuff, which I know you have, you start to wonder, maybe an externalized manifested thought form is possible. And to the point at which other people see it besides just the percipient.
Well, I mean...
The main percipient or the perpetrator, whatever you want to call him.
I mean, one perfect example almost, kind of similar in fiction, is in the movie The Forbidden Planet, where, the scientist, this elderly guy, he has these nightmares of these ancient race that lives on this particular planet.
Yes.
And when he has these
Walter
nightmares...
Walter Pidgeon!
Yeah, Walter Pidgeon, that's right. And his name is Morbius, I think. And he, in his nightmares, they come to life, where these creatures he has these nightmares about, one of them at least, starts wandering around the planet and killing people.
Yes.
But it's basically not real. It's born out of his subconscious, and his subconscious externalizing this thing and giving it some form of rudimentary existence, if you like. And it has a hot Anne Francis in a little miniskirt as well. So.
Yeah, well, that's what she runs around in the miniskirt. Yeah.
And also Leslie Nielsen, who was in the Naked Gun and Airplane movies. He's the captain.
He's the very serious captain.
Yeah, exactly. And Robbie the Rover.
Robbie, he says. Wait, do I have... I think I have a song on here by Messerschmitt called Professor Morbius's something. Let me find it. It's a good one. And it has a lot of lines from the Forbidden Planet.
Professor Morbius's sound. Golden Water.
Yes. There it is. Little Princess of Professor Morbius. I'm going to play it and let Nick listen to it. Or maybe I can unplug the... No, I can't unplug the headphones because then I can't record this. But let me play... Do you mind, Nick?
No, I don't mind at all, man.
It's a 3-minute song here.
For a website, it was really...
Whoa, what was that?
MJ-12.
Yeah, it was MJ-12.
They are this.
There it is. Little Princess of Professor Morbius by Messer Choops.
What do you mean, Commander, the lieutenant and I were just trying to get a little healthy stimulation from hugging and kissing, that's all.
Oh, that's all.
I don't know, really. It was awful. I was only trying to be nice about kissing the lieutenant. But why don't you kiss me like everybody else does? What's wrong with my clothes? I designed them myself. And then I'll put more guards on the guard. That's Little Princess of Professor Morbius. You want to hear another one? It's like their stuff is... Yeah, see how it's delayed? It drives you nuts.
Oh, yeah.
That's why I can't listen to it while it's recording. I think Nick would like this kind of music because basically it's surf horror music. Oh, there's one about zombies.
Yay.
Let's find this the zombie one.
I saw it go down. I saw it the other way.
Really?
Yeah, a bit further there. Zombie in a miniskirt.
No, that's not it, actually. Oh, it's an old zombie movie, and it's a guy telling this black dude that he's a zombie, and there's nothing he can do about it. It's a very good song, and of course I can't find it right now.
On the page that they're going to be streaming the Mars landing on, people are discussing aliens. They're like, great, go ahead and announce it so all the Martians can go underground and hide.
I can hear Sigrid coming through on the radio.
Yes, she's coming through. I like that. Oh, well. Well, let's just play the
See how they wiggle, wiggle.
And we'll be back here in a second with Nick.
Squiggle and hiss. Imagine the thrill of having one squirm across your foot.
Hiss the snakes goodbye now, gang. We must be moving on.
Ah, yes. On to the cave where my battering battalion of bats hang out. Suckers. This is the end. Shh. See how they wiggle, squiggle, squiggle, and hiss. Reach up to the giant. Ever so carefully. Suckers.
It was Little Bloodsucker. Messer Choops. Before that, I can't even remember what I played.
Messer Choops.
Yes. The song Messer Choops. The thing that made me laugh most today was Nick talking about Jonathan Downs from the Center for Fortean Zoology. There's a series of books called, what are they called?
The Mammoth Books.
Yes.
The Mammoth Books of Jack the Ripper, or the Mammoth Books of UFOs, etc.
It's basically a British version of For Dummies, I guess. But they're really thick books.
Oh, well, they are. They're extensive books. And John offered them the Mammoth Book of Mammoths, which they didn't buy.
Did you
it
ever...
would have been a good one.
Have you told the grape jam, strawberry jam story on this show? I think you should repeat it because I like that story. Oh, Sigrid loves that story because she's been to UFO conventions.
Well, yeah, I mean, basically, it's like one of those things that I guess people either find funny or they think what was funny about that. But John once posed a question at a UFO conference on something that had absolutely nothing to do with UFOs, which I think is kind of appropriate and perfect. And the question basically went like this. It was that if strawberry-flavoured jam is called strawberry jam...
And it was right after this, like, really serious UFO lecture.
Exactly. Like, you know, when
everybody's asking, well, what do you think of the, where are the underground bases and how do they fit into the evil government, the evil shadow government's plan?
Evil agenda.
And then Jonathan raised his hand and said, I've got the question.
Yeah, John says, if strawberry flavored jam is called strawberry jam and raspberry flavored jam is called raspberry jam, why is orange flavored jam called marmalade? And of course there was like stunned silence in the room because everybody was expecting questions on, you know, what was the Roswell debris made out of or whatever, you know. Which I thought was like a classic question. I have to remember that one.
Well, Nick and I keep daring each other if we're ever at the same conference that one of us will stand up and ask that question.
Actually, a friend of mine, Matthew Williams, I think you've met.
Yes.
Matthew did, years ago, back in the mid-90s, put a UFO documentary together, and one of the people he interviewed was Nick Pope, the former Ministry of Defence guy who investigated UFOs.
He told me that one.
And Matthew said, you know, something along the lines of, Nick, you know, you spent 3 years investigating UFO encounters for the British Ministry of Defence, and, you know, you spoke and analysed reports from the military, from the police and the public. And, you know, at the end of the day, what's your favourite colour? And again, there was kind of like a stunned, unanticipated silence.
Did he answer?
I have no idea. I probably would have probably been grey, but I don't know if it was. But I like that kind of stuff where it kind of messes around with the UFO subject. Because it deserves to be messed around with. So.
Well, I did have that hoax I pulled on my friends in 95 or 6 or so. And people don't bring that up very
much. Oh, when you made a UFO or something.
Yeah, with helium balloons and light sticks. Mm-hmm. In the middle of the wilderness in New Mexico.
Oh, that's cool.
Quite appropriate, New Mexico. Mm-hmm,
yeah, exactly. I like humor in ufology, though. I don't think there's enough humor in the entire 14 field. It's all very dour and dark and, you know, strawberry ice cream aliens.
You got to be very serious.
Well, but, you know, there should be... I mean, literally joking aside, there are a lot of absurdities in every aspect of the UFO phenomenon. I mean, entire swathes of people took very seriously the idea that the Greys like strawberry ice cream.
Did they really?
Well, apparently, yeah.
All I heard is people saying he's ruined ufology because it had such a wonderful reputation before.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of, oh, here comes the black helicopters.
Yeah, now they hear us making fun of the strawberry ice cream.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, even if they do like strawberry ice cream, how in the hell did the government find out in the first place they like strawberry ice cream? You know, it's like
Tibetan music because it levitates stones.
Yeah, so. I mean, what did they do? Like, say, somebody was playing, like, I don't know, the Rolling Stones or the Beatles, and one of the aliens said, turn that crap off and give us a bit of the sitar or something, you know what I mean? Crank up the sitar or whatever, I don't know. But, you know, I mean, it's like the strawberry ice cream thing. People accepted that. Oh my God, the aliens like strawberry ice cream, without even giving much thought to how did anybody even find
that
out.
It's coming from a government person. He's letting us in on secrets. It must be true.
Yeah, and I mean, for me, that sort of stuff is funny. You know, and I don't apologise for the fact that I rolled around the room the first time I heard that strawberry ice cream story because it was amusing. It wasn't a revelation about the true nature of the Greys.
Really, my jaw just kind of drops like, what? What the hell is he talking about?
Yeah.
Because I was listening, like, this is probably real important stuff. And then that hit me, I'm like, what?
Yeah, and I mean...
This is a year after I met Moore, too, actually. Or no, about the time I did meet him, because that was the year before... Was it the year before or year after? It was the year before. Las Vegas.
And I mean, that whole Tibetan music thing, it's so predictable. Oh, yeah, the aliens like spiritual Tibetan music. You know, why don't they listen to, like, GBH or somebody like that? You know what I mean? Why don't they?
Imagine them there, like, waving their heads like Beavis and Butthead?
Yeah. Or why don't they like... Or why don't they like something like Eddie Cochran or Deep Purple or, you know, who knows, whatever.
Yeah.
Why has it got to be, oh, yeah, they like really spiritual whatever music, you know. I mean, to me, it's just laughable. There's so many...
What do you think was the reason for saying strawberry? You know, you could ask Rick Doty, but what's the reason for saying strawberry ice cream and Tibetan music?
Well, I do sometimes wonder if some of these crazy aspects are introduced to make the real aspects sound ridiculous. I actually do think that could happen at times, you know, that there are people who've been deliberately hired or whatever to either obfuscate the truth or make it look stupid by just inserting things that are going to get so much publicity and coverage and the story's going to spread for years.
Yeah.
That it really has a negative effect. You know, that's true.
For what reason? For what reason, though?
Because the government knows it's a real phenomenon and it may not know what it is, but it wants to do its best to basically...
Cover up the ignorance
and make the whole thing seem ridiculous. I mean, that strawberry ice cream thing, that was like 88. That's a quarter of a century ago. People are still... Well, we're wittering on about it now. You know, that just demonstrates how it's become part of UFO culture. It's like anal probes, you know. Whether or not the aliens do anal probes or not, the fact is it's become a major laughing point within...
Woodley Streber made that joke when I had dinner with him. He told some story, and then he said, well, this is coming from somebody who says he had aliens shove things up his butt.
Yeah.
He actually said that to me, which I thought was hilarious.
Yeah, I mean, but it's like there's so much absurdity in ufology, and a lot of researchers don't like that because they feel it detracts from it. But the fact is...
Detracts from what? Nobody cares about it. But we're trying to get people to be serious about it.
Well, I mean, I can think of countless... I mean, Buck Nelson selling his dog's hair as alien dog hair. What's his name? Who had the... was given the alien pancakes.
Simonton.
Yeah.
Cookies or pancakes.
Joe Simonson was supposedly given pancakes.
Eagle River, Wisconsin.
Yeah. Interestingly enough, those pancakes didn't contain any salt.
They were unleavened bread.
Yeah, and in
Jewish aliens.
And in Middle Ages times in England, when the fairies would give gifts, they would lack salt because fairies can't abide salt.
Mm.
So, you know, you got little
parallels. I remember this. And this
so maybe Simonson's case isn't totally...
Ridiculous.
But there are a lot of absurdities in ufology.
I wrote something on that.
But so many people want to...
About the significant... What's the word?
It was analyzed by the Food and Whatever Administration or something, you know.
No, it was... I did a symbolic analysis of the Simonton case.
Oh, okay.
Like, you know, what was he given? They were like communion wafers.
Oh,
you know?
I see, yeah.
Where did... Mm. The men were all dressed in black. They were cooking on this stove that looked like an iron stove. I went through this whole thing and did this, like, totally whacked out analysis of the symbology of the Simonton case.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to read one of the funniest UFO things ever... Get the Jerome Clark Encyclopedia and read the entire section, which is about 10 pages, called Sex and UFOs. Mm-hmm. It is one of the funniest UFO sections, you know, segments of UFO stuff I've ever read.
Well, you know, I mean, it's like all aspects of the paranormal actually have major sexual components to them.
Yes,
you know, everything
yes.
from incubus, succubus stories...
Bigfoots hanging around lovers' lanes.
Yeah, things like in the Middle Ages again. You know, fairies having an obsession with human reproduction, stealing babies and replacing them with changelings.
The first Mothman sighting was two couples in a car, like going to a makeout place at the.
Well, you know, I mean, I kind of tie a lot of this in with sort of, you know, Wilhelm Reich and Orgon energy.
Yes,
you know, the idea of sexual energy, literally being an energy. You know, that we could be dealing with something that, you know, goes far beyond just having a quick shag. You know, you know that in the sense
the belittling language we use.
Yeah, a bloody good quick shag. But yeah, I mean, the whole idea that, you know, entire swathes of the paranormal field are saturated in sexual stories, you know, human beings having sexual interactions with higher entities from some other realm. You know, you can place different...
Oh, well, yeah, that's a very old theme.
Yeah, and you can place different cultural perceptions and ideas on it, but it all comes down to that. You know,
yeah, apparently people coming from other planets have a similar biology. I don't know how that worked out. Just ask Antonio Villas-Boas. So.
Well, yeah, I mean, with his hot space babe who apparently got pregnant and who pointed to her stomach and the stars, you know, and how she knew, you know, within 30 seconds of the act that she was about to...
Oh, well,
pop in 9 months or whatever, you know.
Yeah, apparently they have not mastered the art of... At that point, they had not mastered the art of artificial insemination, so...
But she did have a few strange things about her. She had bright red pubic hair.
Yeah, well, all her hair was bright red. She had very white skin, a pointed chin, and I think she had cat eyes.
The one thing I do like most of all...
And she made grunting...
She growled like a dog, which I thought was totally cool, you know. That's almost as good as, like...
I'm waiting for the movie, like, recreation of that.
That's kind of, like, as good as Leave Your Shoes On, you know what I mean? So. As Sigrid looks on at me as if...
She's not even paying attention.
No.
No?
I heard something about red pubic hair.
Okay.
Could you read that back to us, please? There was something about... folk wisdom and then red pubic hair.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of, you know, I mean, joking aside, but these stories parallel, you know, 500 years ago, somebody being taken to the fairy kingdom and being told to mate with a fairy queen, you know, yeah. Or 2,000 years ago in ancient Babylonia, somebody has a nighttime visitation from a predatory female vampire type creature, that sort of thing, that stole the person's energy or whatever, you know.
Yeah, well, this all points back to the people looking for something coming from other planets when it's been with us for so long and intimately, you know, and almost literally connected us for so long, and tends to argue against the extraterrestrial thing, mm-hmm. unless they've got some weird thing where that's how the interface is done, which you know, if there are aliens and they are interacting with mm-hmm. us from other planets, it's very interesting they would choose to use that. Mm-hmm. And been using it for thousands and thousands of years, as long as people have been saying there's things that aren't human mm-hmm. encountering us occasionally.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the problem is that every culture, if you like, not only places its own perception on it, but the quote, experts in that field then kind of hijack it to the point where it's like it becomes literally kind of like a belief system becomes a fact, basically, you know, and it becomes, and in today's world, ufology has become a major business. Now, you know, people say, well, Nick writes books. Yeah, I do. But I don't force feed belief systems on people. I relate data and share it with people. You know, and I think when you start getting in the business of saying, well, this sexual component is because of this or that, that's when you hit problems. You know, when you
start assigning one motivation or one yes. theme to something that can't really be proven by anybody, mm-hmm. not by going and doing research on it. The only research you can do is by looking at reports and data mm-hmm. and people relating these things for mm-hmm. hundreds of years and then trying to draw something from that. Mm-hmm. And like one of the commenters on UFO Mystic said once, playing with an idea a bit and not being attached to one hypothesis, because that's mm-hmm. when you've shut everything down. And if you hear a lot of these paranormal shows or people talking on radio shows or whatever, they've all got an agenda, because that's how they get people listen to them, and they kind of stick to that agenda, and they're defending it against people who say, well, what about? Well, they will discount that, or they will change the subject, or whatever. Which reminds me of another thing. Nick said he wrote something recently about what are the 10 commandments of paranormal television right now. What are they?
Well, if you type, do you want to get my blog up? You'll find
yeah.
it. Yeah, I mean, it's...
Which one? Something in the Woods?
No, nickredfern14.blogspot.com. basically, the idea was, I've got sort of sick and tired of all this sort of reality TV where all it is today in the paranormal field is a bunch of people running around the woods. Hang on, there we are. Basically, with Nightscope equipment and basically saying, what the hell was that? That's all it's about. So if you want to read that, Greg, you can. If you want to, I don't mind.
Okay. Commandment one, thou shalt always have thy team comprised of more men than women. The former should generally sport some form of headwear, either a baseball cap or something befitting Indiana Jones. The latter should be kept away from manna from heaven and the food of the gods. Anorexic looking, in other words. Oh, you want me to read them all?
I don't care.
Ensure that the cast doth drive a flashy all-terrain vehicle rather than a car. If that same vehicle can be filled with lots of cameras, weird-looking devices, and advanced technologies, and bountiful shots of such items can be captured for the user, ye shall reap rewards beyond thy imagination. That's to say, you'll get your expenses paid a week early. Three, lest ye risk facing the wrath of the Almighty, in the case of the TV channel that's funding the show. Thou shalt secure a great deal of night vision footage, and not for any particular reason, aside from, well, it's night vision footage, and everyone's show has it, so why not our heroes, too? Thy heroes. Number four, to avoid forever being plunged into the heart of some hellish realm, ensure that at least every 5 minutes, one of thy cast members utters a variation of the following words, which must always be whispered other than spoken or shouted. What the hell was that? Did you hear that? What the fuck was that? And can you see that? You're right, Nick. Five, take careful steps to never forget that when a commercial break doth loom and large on the horizon, thou shalt build up the atmosphere with something that appears to be mysterious. Yet, lo and behold, after the break, the team will resolve the matter in a down-to-earth, jokey, semi-relieved style. Six, verily, in the commercials that promote the show in the hours before it is broadcast, always be careful to ensure that at least one person's words are edited in a fashion that takes them totally out of their original context, which Nick knows from personal experience, and me for a little bit of personal experience. Seven, stress thy heroes of the hour, or half an hour, depending on budget. At some point, they must speak in an out-of-breath fashion. If this can be done by running from something terrible, but actually non-existent, ye shall be granted entrance into the next joyous realm of existence. Or it's also, as it's also known, season two. Eight, never forget the haunted houses and creature-infested woods should not be entered to until the sun is set and darkness is upon both ye and the land. Daylight shootings will provoke a wrath of unimaginable horror. The almost unspeakable name is falling ratings. Nine, do thy utmost to make sure that the team comes across as more learned and intelligent than the witnesses they encounter on their journey towards enlightenment. And commandment 10, finally, the most important commandment of all and one of the definitive behind-the-scenes proportions. When trying to secure the services of people to appear on thy show, always ensure that the researcher whose job it is to phone the witness, authors, and investigator reads the following sacred verse. Hi, I'm Insert Name from the Insert Name channel. We would like to interview you for our show. Yes, again, Insert Name. But unfortunately, we can't pay you as we don't have much of a budget. Yes, you do, you lying prick. But it'd be good publicity for you, and we'll try and pay all of your airfare and even buy you a Coke. How's that sound?
That's my top 10.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, yeah, joking aside, you know,
I don't think joking should be aside.
Well,
go ahead.
You know, it's like when reality TV started, in some cases, it was kind of groundbreaking and new and was refreshing and new and vital. Today, most paranormal TV stuff, which is sort of on the road type stuff, is just literally dominated by night vision footage of people literally running around the woods, as you said, saying, what the hell's that? What the hell's that? You know, and they just drive all-terrain vehicles. Somebody whispers, you know, footage is shown of something before the commercial break, and then when they come back, you know, it wasn't Bigfoot, it was an armadillo, you know.
Yes.
And it's just lazy TV. There's just nothing new. And it isn't even real investigations. It's just, let's hit this particular town where Mothman was seen 50 years ago. Let's get some stock footage. Let's interview the same old people. Let's go out to one particular area, film a bit of late night footage. You whisper, you claim to have seen something, we'll go home. And that passes for investigative paranormal TV today. And it's just bullshit, you know, it's just crap.
Yeah, I had I had another one there. Oh, how many times, Nick, have you been called up and somebody's asking you questions about something, ostensibly to try and have you on the show, and basically they're just mining you for information?
Oh, well,
every time?
No, that actually doesn't happen much, because after the first couple of times, I realized what they were doing. And
yeah.
So when somebody phones me up and sends me an email and says something to the effect of, you know, we're making this show and we'd really like to get like 10 abductees on the program, can you help us? I say, yeah, sure I can. This is what I charge by the hour.
Yeah.
And
that gets rid of probably all of them, just about.
Most of them it does, but you do find the, you know, a few who are honest, who say, okay, you know, if you can provide this and you can, you know, I've been hired to, you know, get copyright releases on photographs, that sort of thing. But for the most part, yeah, you know, these people are scum. They just want something for nothing. They want you to do all the work for them. And at the end of the day, you know, this is what really pisses me off, is that the people who are on the shows are the ones who get treated most shabbily. You know, the production companies, all those guys are union guys. You know, after a certain number of hours, they've got to stop. You know, come hell or high water.
Yeah.
They stop for lunch, dinner, whatever. They're on set rates. And yet when it's the people on the show, oh, well, you know, we don't have much of a budget. Well, of course they do. You're on this channel or you're on that channel. It's a primetime TV show. You know, don't insult people's intelligence by saying, oh, we got no budget. Of course you do. You know, but they'll soon be quick enough to book your airfare or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, and to me, it's just crap. You know, if you want people on your show,
just interview them by Skype. Give me airfare money.
Well, you know, if you're going to have people on your show, treat them with respect. And if you're going to treat what you do as a business in terms of the channel, then treat it as a business with the people you have on the show as well.
So. Nick, are you going to be any paranormal shows in the near future?
Probably not after this, no. I'm sure that may well have brought things down to a grinding halt.
Well, that's why, like Nick, he generally does not care very much what people think. No. Within reason. I mean, he doesn't care what he thinks about his opinions, actually.
No, I mean, you know, in terms of data, I want to be able to share new and important information and data with people. And if people disagree with me and we can have a debate about why there might be a disagreement, that doesn't bother me in the slightest. And I think that's important that we do debate different theories, you know. You know, if somebody says to me, I disagree with your theories on Roswell, that doesn't bother me. I don't get offended. Let's debate why you think it's this and I think it's that.
Yeah.
But I do get, you know, that's all fine. But when people just, you know, I mean, you know, life's too short to just worry about what somebody thinks of you.
What's the most surprising, violent, I don't know, funny reaction somebody's had at a conference, like where they stand up to give questions?
About my stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
Mine's
Chuck Wade.
I've never really had a violent response.
Well,
what I have had on...
A memorable.
Okay. It's always a variation on the thing that Nick's being paid by the government to, you know, spread disinformation, which is the most bullshit thing I've ever heard. You know, it's kind of like right now, I'm saving money up to replace the two front tyres on my car. Would I really be doing that if I was being paid by the Illuminati at like 50 grand a week or something ridiculous?
You can say whatever you want. You probably live in a really nice house and have a very nice car.
You know, but I mean, joking aside, I do get that. I even had somebody say, oh, Nick wears black because it's like a sign of some occult shit or whatever. I wear black because I kind of grew up listening to punk and goth music, and I like black clothes. You know, the easiest explanation is the true one. But, you know, it's kind of like, for some reason, if you say something that goes against the ufological grain, there has to be some sinister reason why you're saying it, or some hidden reason. It can't just be that you... God forbid, it's just that you disagree. You know, that can't be that simple. So, I do get that a lot. But, you know, I mean, it's one of these things. If people take offence because I say or write something, if they take real offence to it, that's because they're so ingrained in belief that they cannot look outside of that angle. You know, they're offended because I've dared to shake up or question their belief system. Well, I don't care if people have beliefs, but as long as you admit and recognise that a belief is a belief, you know, it, or a conclusion is a conclusion. It's not necessarily a hard fact.
Or, it's not necessarily reality.
No, it may be, but it's proving that it's reality. That's the important thing. And until we can do that, you know, all bets should be open. But I get that. But, I mean, again, you know, I simply don't care if someone's offended, because there are things about the subject that are ridiculous. And, you know, the problem is that I see it, a lot of the UFO field is based around upholding the business angle. Now, people say, oh, well, Nick writes UFO books, so he's in the UFO business. But I'm not in the business of saying what I think people want to hear. You know, I mean, there's nothing special about me, but I don't know many people in the UFO field who would have written my Body Snatchers in the Desert, even if they believe that theory, because they would be too worried about whether it would affect their position on the lecture circuit. I don't care about if it affects my position. I wrote the book because I thought the story needed to be told. You know, if somebody don't want to book me for my conference because I dared suggest maybe aliens didn't crash at Roswell, well, fuck them. You know, that's not something that bothers me, or I'm going to lose any sleep over. You know, at the end of the day, none of us really know what lies at the heart of the UFO mystery. We're all looking for answers, and some of the answers may be what we want to hear, some of them may not. And that's how it goes, you know. So.
Yeah, well, once again, you can see why Nick and I get along so well, because he takes the words right out of my mouth. Why should anybody be dogmatic about any of this stuff? Because you can learn so much more by just kind of listening, and some of the stuff may be more. I've changed my opinion about the UFO thing 3 or 4 different times since I started looking at it. Mosley admits that he's done the same thing.
Well, everybody does. The only ones who don't, I actually don't think most of them are dishonest. It just becomes, they become so enraptured, and it's usually by the ETH. You know, it's kind of like, if you don't leave the ETH angle behind or question it, you are going to become stuck in that for life.
Yeah.
And I don't think the people who do get stuck in it are fantasists, liars, used car salesmen. They really do believe that theory.
Yeah. Oh, of course, yeah.
But that doesn't make it right. It means they have a vehement belief system that it is right, which is a very different thing.
Well, Walter just popped up. Well, Carlos said on Facebook here, aliens are haunting lovers' lanes. The ones who are haunting lovers' lanes are nerdy teenage aliens who can't get dates with aliens of the opposite sex. The ones who anal probe hillbillies are alien hillbillies. Walter says, ask Nick what he... Oh, well, before that even, Adam Gorightly said, ask Nick who does his hair, which I thought
I
was...
Do.
A,
yes.
I've seen him do his hair.
Yeah, I do it in the morning when I get up. If I go out at night on the town, I do it again.
Yeah, ask Nick... I've seen him do it too. You ought to get a straight razor, I think. It'd be a lot more romantic. Although you'd probably cut yourself. Yeah. Ask Nick what he thinks about the missing people in national parks.
Missing people in national parks?
He says he's. I'm not listening, so I don't know what you're on. On what? We're not on anything, Walter.
I don't really know about missing people in national parks.
The only ones I can think of are ones that were, like, you know, murdered or whatever.
Yeah, so I'm not a...
Nick's volume is a bit lower than yours. It's because I talk loudly, because I think I'm right and nobody else is.
No, I don't know anything about missing people in national parks, unfortunately.
I'll write Nick and I, and I don't.
I do remember some weird story once. Wasn't there a story about some guy who was found, like, mutilated in a national park, and it was, like, put down to something like a cattle mute or something. I'm not sure. That's an interesting angle, human mutilations. But.
It's funny, in 1994 or 1993 or something like that, when the Austin MUFON happened, I interviewed Carla Turner.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't know anything about this at the time. I didn't. She said, do you want to tell me to tell you about some human mutilations that have been happening in South America? And I said, what? And then we got distracted, and she never told me. Just like the 1950s hairy dwarves thing, and all the weirdness in South America, apparently there were human-type mutilations in type. There were human mutilations by, death and mutilations by unknown means.
around UFO flaps.
Mm-hmm. There's actually a reference in the FBI's declassified Cattle Butte file, which you can find at their website, The Vault. There's actually a small section in there which discusses rumors about human mutilations in 75. You know, there's not a great deal, but, you know, the mere fact that there's something, you know, is kind of interesting. I know Don Ecker, formerly of UFO Magazine, he uncovered a number of stories of human mutes as well. So, I mean, it's one of these things that's sort of, you know, very kind of controversial, obviously, but, you know, I think it's something worth looking into.
Yeah. The funny thing is, right after she said that, she said, Carla said, I'd like you to, maybe you can meet this guy that's looking into human mutilations and implants. His name is Daryl Sims.
Yeah.
Remember him?
Yeah, whatever happened to Daryl Sims?
I don't know what happened to Daryl Sims.
He's kind of gone quiet the last few years. I think the last time I saw him was at a conference, but I mean, must have been, I'm not sure how many years ago, but, you know, I think there's a lot of controversial stuff within the field, like mutilations, whether animal or cattle or whatever, I mean, animal or people or whatever, you know, and you know, the sort of things we've discussed tonight just sort of demonstrate that, you know, I mean, where are we going with it, you know, can we go anywhere further than we've gone already, so.
Further with the UFO thing?
Well, yeah, or paranormal in general. You know, it's kind of like we get...
It's kind of holding its breath right now?
Well, you know, we get so far where we get all the case files, we get the reports, but we never get the hard evidence. And that's been the same from people rapping on tables to investigating goblins or gin or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, you get really good reports, witness encounters, but we never get the hard evidence. Like Roswell, really interesting case, but whatever happened, not a shred of verifiable debris or materials or nothing.
Well, Chuck Wade has some.
Well, go on, you tell that story. I don't know that one.
He's a guy that said he found Roswell debris on his property, and he had all these samples of like pieces of metal.
Okay.
And I was at the...
I was at Ryan's conference.
No, it was at this... Well, when I saw him was at what's the one in...
Laughlin.
No. The one in New Mexico. Janet Aztec. Saylor puts on.
Aztec. Oh, Angel Fire.
Yeah, the Angel Fire conference. I did the Aliens Aren't From Other Planets maybe thing, and Chuck Wade got it. He said, well, what about this? And he had this like notebook full of pieces of metal that are all rusted. And I said, what's that, Chuck? I have no idea what this is. He said, this is Roswell debris. I said, how do you know that? He said, because it crashed on my property and some of the debris... And I said... How do you know it's from an alien, whatever? He says, well, we're having it analyzed. I said, you haven't finished the analyzing yet? No, not yet. And I said, well, then how can you say that? And he sat down and crossed his arms and actually looked away from me. I mean, and that's basically the attitude from a lot of people.
Well, you know.
And I said, look, I don't know what that is. Mm-hmm. I don't know if anybody really knows what that is. When you get the analysis done, put the results out and see what people think. Maybe then people will change their minds. Until then, it's just your opinion. He got mad at me for saying that.
Well, I think one of the reasons why... I mean, a lot of people do get mad over Roswell. And I think one of the reasons for that is purely and simply because Roswell is, you know, one of these real sort of make or break cases. You know, if Roswell's proved to be alien, then we prove the case, you know. If it's proved not to be alien, then a significant percentage of the whole house of cards comes tumbling down. You know, it's not just another sighting or another case or, you know, did George Adamski photograph flying saucers or did he photograph lampshades, you know. It's not...
What did it say in that FBI file? It was a tobacco humidifier with ping pong balls taped to the bottom.
Take that, George. But, I mean, sometimes, you know, it makes me wonder, is it all worthwhile? Because I know, you know, if I live to be 95, I know I'm going to be like Kehoe and Hynek, where you go to your grave, never really knowing.
Yeah.
It doesn't stop me trying to find the answers. But no. I know at the end of the day, we're all going to be the same as all the ones who came before us, you know. And 100 years from now, there'll be another 25 books on Roswell. You know, the super truth about the Roswell crash, or the extra truth about the Roswell crash, you know.
Or, yeah, or the...
the real alien, the real
new,
alien
the new physics angle on the Roswell
crash. Yeah, exactly, you know. And,
well, my idea for many years is, for a while now, has been what... The breakthrough in the UFO thing will come from outside the UFO field, and it will come from somebody making a breakthrough in how we look at the way things are, how physics looks at the way the world is put together, and how we perceive it, and, you know, from the psychological angle, from the perceptual angle. I think those are the breakthroughs that are coming through, and people that are interested in the UFO thing should be paying attention to those fields, not to, you know, the latest sighting report or how many implants somebody has in them.
And I think, you know, when it comes to... I do think government agencies know more than we think they know, or that, I mean, they're willing to admit, I should say. And I think if anything comes out of government, I don't personally think it's going to come through disclosure. I don't have any faith in the disclosure movements achieving disclosure at all. I think it's a very laudable and worthwhile thing in terms of the people being honest and earnest. But I think it's naive to think the government will release anything really significant, because it'll open a floodgate to all sorts of questions. But what I do think is that if we get answers from the governments, it won't be through FOIA, it won't be through disclosure, it'll be through somebody making a mistake and something gets released in error, and that opens a floodgate, if you like. I think that could happen, possibly, you know, where it, there's a reference in a file to something that's classified and, you know, has a bearing on a famous case, maybe.
I see your level going down. What, you're looking at all the messages we're getting on Facebook?
Yeah. With a large lander, use retro rockets and landing legs to touch down about 6 miles an hour.
Ken Thomas is listening to us, and he's sent us a link for the NASA feed. We found out that the area around Griffith Observatory is apparently really, really crowded, and the traffic's really bad. If we drove over there, even now, the... apparently the indeed, traffic would keep us even from getting up there.
That's so what Nick the government wants us to think.
Yeah, exactly. Or at least Sigrid does. So what we've decided to do is stay here and just talk a little while longer, maybe another, what, half hour or so.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah. Then we can have go get some more beer and watch the Mars lander either land or crash.
Well, no, I think the feed will go off. Great.
Yeah, it will land. It's just a matter of how fast.
I think the feed's going to get lost, and then there'll be all sorts of speculation as to what actually really happened. And somebody will have a book out on it next year.
I'll try and get one out on it next month. Or remember that, the Russian one, that the last shot they had was like something that looked like...
Oh, yeah.
Remember in the, what was it, the early 90s
sometime?
Yeah, maybe
20 years ago.
The Phobos probe, yeah, or whatever it was.
Well, I mean, you know, there are some weird anomalies in space, you know. I mean, obviously the biggest one people talk about is like the face on Mars.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, is it a case of people seeing faces in clouds? Or is it something real, you know?
Did you see the higher resolution photos of it that came later?
Yeah.
It looks nothing like a face anymore.
No, I mean, well,
however,
it looks like a face that's been through a car windshield at like 90 miles an hour.
Yeah. And the point that Mac makes in Martian Apocalypse is that there's symmetry in the face and in the eyes and the irises of the eyes that are really hard to reconcile with simple natural formation. I mean, it could happen, but the likelihood is, he put the likelihood up at some astronomically high number.
Yeah, I mean, Mac did point out that even though it looks damaged and pummeled, well, if it's half a million years old, with the weather, who knows what else it would do. But if you kind of squint at that,
it looks like the Mars face again.
Yeah, it still looks more like a face that's been pummeled. And
well, it looks like one of those images you see where everything is turned into blocks of pixels.
Yeah,
and if you squint, you can actually see what the thing is.
Okay, I think there's a genuine argument for saying we should be digging into these Martian anomalies, you know, these pyramid type structures, etc. You know, I think there's some interesting stuff to see. Doesn't necessarily mean it is alien, But, you know, if we're going to be open-minded and want to get the truth, why ignore it? You know, I've never really understood that. There's, you know, that's the thing that annoys me about the debunkers. They're so lofty in their view that, oh, I'm not even going to look at that. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like, well, then you're actually falling into the trap that you accuse the UFO researchers of doing, of not looking at all the evidence.
Yeah.
You know, so.
If you look at all the evidence, you come away confused.
Well,
not you don't come away, if you come away believing in one side or the other, then there's something wrong with you, I think. Or you've made up your mind before you've looked at the evidence. If you come away with a belief system after looking at a lot of the evidence, you come away thinking there might be something here, but I'm not sure what. At least that's, I think, that any sane person would say that.
No, you're right, and I think
for any of these things, for ghosts or for UFO thing or the face on Mars or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, a full on 100% believer is basically not no different to a full on 100%
disbeliever. They're both forms of belief.
Both forms of belief, and they're both rigidly held and both rigidly adhered to, and neither side has any room for the argument of the other person, which, you know, for me, that's totally the wrong way, if you like.
Yeah. Well, I was made aware of that by reading The New Inquisition by Robert Anton Wilson.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Which is probably, like, in my top five, along with Body Snatchers in the Desert and...
don't tell people that.
Oh, okay.
No, I don't care. I'm joking.
Well, that's a number of three or four of your books would be in my top ten.
No, well,
any one of them. And the... What about yours? What's your top five paranormal books, Nick? Not necessarily in order of importance or anything.
Messages of Deception.
Oh, yes, that's in mine.
And not just because you're here, I would say Project Beta. And one of the reasons I would say that...
What?
No, seriously, I would say that because what you demonstrated with that book is that you cannot trust everything that comes out of government. And number two... That book demonstrated that governments create and circulate bogus materials on UFOs. And with that in mind, you know, we either take, a lot of people take the view the government won't tell us the truth, or they're subtly releasing the truth.
Yeah.
You pointed out that there's another angle, and that's that the UFO community is being played on a massive scale.
Yeah.
And to the extent where these stories...
The entire UFO community has been Benowitzed for like 30 years.
And I think you skillfully did that in probably the only time it's been done at book length. So I'd say Project Beta, Messengers of Deception, Operation Trojan Horse, John Keel, because that really shows the manipulative aspect of the genuine phenomenon and how it changes over the years in different ways. So
Most definitely.
I'd say those three. I would say... how many did you say? Five.
Yeah.
If I had to pick another two...
Doesn't have to be, I mean, UFO and paranormal.
Well, I mean, I would probably pick maybe even Keel's Mothman Prophecies, because that demonstrates to me more than any other the crossover effect between where a lot of these different phenomena that many people see as having no connection actually do cross paths. And I think that's important. So that's four. I mean, it's interesting, you know, that a lot of my favorite ones are books from the past.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, that's at least four I can think of. You know, the only other one that is sort of a new one is yours. And I'm truthfully not just saying that, because you came up with a new book, but on an angle that hasn't really been done to full book length extent, and it's hard to do that in today's world.
That's nice of Nick to say, but it also flatters his prejudices, because I think he was interested in that case and interested in that subject beforehand.
Well, I was. That's true. If I just have to pick one more, you know, I probably would say Gray Barker's They Knew Too Much About Flying Saucers. One of the reasons being that book really gave birth to the whole Men in Black mystery.
Yes.
You know, there's no doubt about that. That book kick-started research and writing on the Men in Black, and that dug into the further realm of the government silencing people and intimidating them because of what the government knows, and it spawned, you know, this whole angle of the government watching us as a community. And so in terms of significance, I think that was a very significant book. You know, you could even argue, even though I don't think much of the book, you could argue that Frank Scully's Behind the Flying Saucers was massively important because it really gave birth to the idea that UFOs had crashed, which is one of the cornerstones of today's ufology. You know, everybody, a lot of people in ufology absolutely believe aliens have crashed. Scully's book, for all its flaws and probably a massive amount of hoax material, was the thing that kickstarted that whole crashed UFO movement. It may have died off and then got a resurgence, but Scully was the guy who began it all.
Yeah.
So different books in different ways. And actually, one I forgot, which I would have to put in there, is Whitley Strieber's Communion.
Oh, yes.
Because hundreds of books have been written now on abductions, but Strieber was willing to go down the path where he was saying, well, it may be extraterrestrials, or it might not, but if it is, they're not acting in the way that most other researchers are saying they're acting.
Yeah.
You know, he really went out on a limb, you know, and started talking about how these entities may have some sort of understanding of a realm of after death. You know, he drew the parallel, you know, went even deeper into the parallels between fairy abductions and alien abductions than
right.
People like Valet went in Messengers of Deception. And I think that book, a lot of people just perceive it as the book that opened the door to modern day abduction stories. It didn't. It opened the door to a more esoteric look at the subject as well.
The first Bud Hopkins book, Missing Time, was probably the one that opened the...
Yeah, but Whitley Strieber's book really opened the door to the
idea... Which was only,
that,
I think, a couple of years after Missing Time, wasn't it?
No, it was 87. I think Missing Time was like 81.
Okay, yeah.
It was like 5 or 6 or 7 years.
Okay, yeah.
But I think Strieber's book really opened the idea that maybe that there's something definite going on, but maybe it's not nuts and bolts aliens as such.
Right.
So, I mean, I could probably pick even more, but that's sort of the top 5, 6, 7 or whatever that I could choose.
What was the third? It was Communion, Transformation, and what was the third one in the...
I think it was called Resolution or...
Confirmation?
Confirmation, that's right, yeah.
I think either the second or third one would probably be my favorite out of
Transformation's
those.
Transformation's a good one, because that goes into... I mean, I remember this one story in Transformation where supposedly the aliens tell him to stop eating sweets.
Yes.
Or he's going to develop diabetes and die. And he's like, well, why should I? And they said, we'll show you. And then, like a day or two later, one of his friends gets in touch, and through the conversation, he mentions this old lady who's dying of diabetes, who saw these little men in the bedroom. You know, and it was like the confirmation that that was meant to get back to him as the part of the message.
Yeah.
You know, it's full of stuff like... That's got nothing to do with nuts and bolts aliens stealing DNA.
No. None of his books have anything to do with that.
That's going down far strange. That's almost like Matrix proportions.
Yeah, I was asking that because I saw my copy of Rebirth of Pan here, and I just thought, I wonder, you know... What do you think of that book? Have you read it?
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know...
That's got to be in, like, it's one of my top five, actually.
Yeah, I mean, if I was going to pick sort of top 5 14 books, I'd put that in there.
Yeah,
you know,
okay.
I mean, you know,
I was just talking in general, like, in the paranormal, be it UFO, cryptozoology, anything.
Well, I mean, one of my favorite ones...
Because that covers all those things. It covers conspiracy, crypto, earth mysteries, UFOs... Lot of stuff in that one book.
I mean, I kind of liken... I mean, The Rebirth of Pan is like the definitive book to cover all that. But I kind of liken it a little bit to sort of the stuff Andy Colvin's doing today.
Yeah.
You know, Andy's going down those same paths of looking into esoteric societies and cover-ups and ancient mysteries and, you know, sort of archaic knowledge in the hands of different people. Yeah. And
I have to admit, half the time Andy's talking, I don't know what he's talking about. Maybe not half, but part of the time, a good significant part of the time, I have to kind of piece together what he's saying because I'm not as conversant with it as he is.
Well, you know, he's got a new Mothman book out.
Really? What's this one?
Well, you know, he did the Mothman He did 3 Mothman photographer books.
Right.
And he did the Mothman Speaks.
He used a review of one of my books as an intro to one of his books.
Oh, okay.
One of his books as an intro to another one of his books.
Oh, that's all right.
Yeah.
But he did the Mothman Speaks and Mothman Speaks 2.
Yeah.
And now he's got Mothman Shrieks.
No.
Yeah. So that's like the 6th one. So I'm sure we're going to see. I like Andy's books. You know, they're good value for money. They're packed.
Yes.
I think it's good. For me, Mothman is like the men, you know, he's like the Men in Black for some reason. It's like one of these things that fascinate people. You know, I've done a couple of books on the Men in Black. I did a introduction for the reissued version of Gray Barker's Secret Terror Amongst Us, the MIB.
Oh, really?
Book. Yeah.
Oh, man, that's one of my favorite books.
Yeah, I did a new introduction for that one.
Didn't you borrow my copy at some point?
But I gave it back.
Yes, you gave it back.
Okay. It's around somewhere here, I'm sure.
Yes.
But, and I'm working on a couple more because I think that sort of fascinates me as much as Mothman fascinates Andy. And I think there's certain cases or events that if you're in these fields, above all else, there's always one that really grips you. You know, maybe with you, it's kind of like the Benowitz stuff or alien writing, you know, that kind of thing. For me, it's like the Men in Black. Andy, it's Mothman. With Stan Friedman, you know, Stan, it's Roswell.
Yeah.
Somebody else, it's crop circles. And I think we all have that kind of one thing, you know, which is good, but, you know, don't become benderized where you're like Albert Bender, where you become obsessed and it becomes...
You know, he lives right near where you're staying.
Yeah, no. Somewhere around.
Like within there. About 2 miles.
Yeah, no, he's like 90-something now. And he's,
yeah.
So all that worrying he did about his health back then... He needn't have worried, you know.
Yeah, he's passed everybody else up.
Yeah. He's sort of gone on and on for... But, I mean, Bender, even though he dropped out the scene, he's one of the most important people in ufology because he gave birth to an entire subculture of ufology. You know, there's that... I mean, he regardless of what people think, he literally is one of the most important people in the field.
Yeah.
You know... Regardless of the fact that you wouldn't have the Will Smith and Tommy Lee Jones films, you wouldn't have the MIB references in the X-Files, you would not have any sort of MIB culture without Albert Bender.
Yeah.
You know, that's an absolute established fact.
Well, do you think there would have been a Roswell without the Berlitz and Moore book?
Probably not. No, because...
Well, also because Stan Friedman heard Jesse Marcel talking about it on a radio station.
Yeah, I mean, that's
the thing.
Bill was looking into it. Stan was looking into it. They both got strands, and that's how, you know, stories often develop. Just unique circumstances of different people being in the right place at the same time. But, you know, what came afterwards was basically following on the groundwork that they laid. Had that book not come out, I would not be so all surprised if nobody had really... focused on it at all.
And you know who never gets mentioned at the Roswell conferences? Berlitz and
Moore, exactly.
Ever.
Yeah, or, no, they don't.
Or you know, and I don't know if Stan says anything about it because he's there all the time, but he bears like probably 50% of the responsibility or blame or credit or whatever you want to call it for the whole thing.
Well, you know, I mean, people... I don't understand why people have this rant against Bill because, you know, forget... You know,
I understand it because, but I don't understand the continuing.
Yeah.
Well, know, it's like, he's a liar. It's like,
well, the
do
thing
you
is,
pay any attention to anything else he ever did?
Yeah, the fact of the matter is, you know, if that book had not come out, I seriously doubt there would have been ongoing research into Roswell. And on top of that, I think there's also the fact that, you know, Bill did a significant number of follow-on privately published reports.
Yeah.
You know, like there was 3 or 4, maybe even 5 or 6 of them in the 80s, which ran to sort of, you know, 60, 70 pages or something like that. Then he did this analytical report on the MJ-12 documents with Jamie Chandra.
Yeah.
You know, forensic stuff.
And in which he actually said that at least half of them were inconclusive or probably fake.
Yeah, exactly. You know, he wasn't.
Which people forget.
It's yeah.
Like, well, what's all this spreading of disinfo? It's like he took all this stuff that got released to him or he made up. And if he made it up, do you think he'd be out there saying, well, it's probably fake?
Yeah, exactly. And so I think a lot of people don't realize the sheer extent to which Bill dug into Roswell far beyond just the book. You know, the book, the thing to remember is that if you're dealing with a government conspiracy on whatever happened at Roswell, and you write the very first book when there's just a limited body of data, well, that's how it's going to be. You know, you can't be blamed for the fact that the first time a book comes out, that the data is limited. It's after the book comes out, the publicity starts to spread. Then somebody's grandfather comes forward and says, hey, I was involved in that.
Yeah.
And then somebody else goes and interviews them. You know what I mean? That's That's how it unfortunately often happens.
Ken Thomas said Reich wrote about Roswell. Yes, he did. He wrote one line in Contact with Space.
Oh, okay.
We drove through Roswell and noticed there was a lot of DOR around.
Oh, okay. Well, you know, I mean, it's
here it comes. Ken's going to type something here. How could you? Why do you guys forget about this? Roswell had a bigger impact on the popular culture than the cult of the few people you guys always discuss.
Well, it may well have had an impact on popular culture, but the important thing is, regardless of what happened, the impact has been relative to the alien angle. And
yeah,
it's an angle, it's a theory, and I think we need to
I don't know how it has a bigger impact than we always discuss it. It's had a huge impact. There was a show called Roswell for a while.
Well, because it's a make or break case. That's the thing with Roswell. It's kind of like with the number of bullets fired when Kennedy got shot. You know, that's the make or break thing that takes it into Oswald territory.
Yeah, or Robert F. Kennedy for that.
Yeah,
matter.
Exactly. And Roswell is the case that could really make the extraterrestrial hypothesis for Roswell. Or if aliens didn't crash, then all the other stuff about alien autopsies and back engineering and, you know, Hangar 18, a lot of this comes into question as well.
Keep talking, Nick.
So, you know, I think it's one of these situations where, really, yes, Roswell's very important, but it's just one of literally thousands and thousands of other cases. You know, you can go back to the 1950s, where there were vehicle interference stories, aliens supposedly taking soil samples, landing cases, close encounters. A lot of people, I don't say they dismiss them, but it's just the historical nature of the phenomenon. A lot of people just aren't equated today with the old books from that era. And a lot of these stories get forgotten about, they get lost, and it's just the same old things time and again that get caught up in popular culture. Roswell, Area 51, the Men in Black. These are sort of the staple parts that people know about, that people listen to and focus on. Well, you know, focus on some of the earlier, equally good, intriguing stuff as well. You know, it doesn't all, you know, exist or fall on the mighty R word, if you like.
I'm trying to find the line from about where he went through Roswell.
Oh, right.
In Contact with Space.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I mean, there's a lot of stuff with Roswell. I mean, Roswell's a weird area. I mean, there's a lot of ghost stories in Roswell, you know.
Yeah.
And all sorts of strange stuff. It's not just the UFO. There's stories about an alligator on the loose there. Somebody saw a Bigfoot on the fringes of town once. A lot of strange stuff like that.
Here we go. This is the actual quote from Contact with Space by Wilhelm Reich, page 119. Pastures disappear. This is as they're traveling from Rangeley, Maine to Tucson, Arizona to engage in what they called drought abatement. Basically, they used the cloudbuster to bring rain to Arizona, which was reported in the papers. Pastures disappeared as we neared the New Mexico border at Bronco. Here, a wide plain covered with grayish-white sand blown by strong winds stretching to the vast horizon completed the impression of desert, quote-unquote. Although it was very hot as we neared Roswell, New Mexico, no orgone flow was visible on the road, which should have been shimmering with heat waves. Instead, DOR was well-marked in the vast west against purplish-black barren mountains, which is probably ruidoso. In the sky is a blinding grayness, and over the horizon is a grayish layer. The caking of formerly good soil was progressively characteristic, and eventually the caked soil prevailed over vegetation, which now consisted only of scattered low bushes while all grass disappeared. That's the entire entry for the area of Roswell, New Mexico.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's anything to do with Roswell, I think, you know, people note the significance of it in some respect, or lack of significance, or, you know, is it related, or is it just a reference to Roswell? You know, it's the problem is Roswell. The biggest problem about Roswell, it's so long ago, nearly everybody's dead. government's not saying anything. So how do we get past this point of, I think aliens crashed. No, you're wrong. I think this happened. You know, and even I'm caught up in that, having written about it.
Yeah.
But the problem is, we're caught up in it because we're at stalemate. And a lot of people, I'll admit we're at stalemate. A lot of people in the subject won't. They take the view that there's still a good chance of other witnesses coming forward. Well, it's 65 years ago. If somebody was 20 guarding the scene, you know, just somebody just enlisted, they'd be 85 now.
Yeah.
You know, in 15 years, they'd be 100. That's how long ago it is.
Yeah.
And it's like, how do we get past where we are now? I just don't know how we do it, you know.
No, I don't think we could do it either. Ken also wants to mention in the Orgonomy Journal of Reich, listen to radio reports about Roswell. I haven't seen that Orgonomy Journal. I don't distrust Ken. I would like to see that. Anyway, yeah, Roswell was kind of sitting there at the bottom of the popular consciousness for a while, I guess, but it was pretty much dead till the book came out.
Well, you know, I think the thing is, Roswell is a fascinating story, and I
don't want to belabor Roswell.
No, I know, but I mean, you know, I don't believe the weather balloon story, and I think there's good evidence that bodies or of some sort were actually found. I won't say evidence, but I think there's enough testimony to suggest that something was recovered, which goes beyond a mogul balloon and crash test dummies.
Right.
Was it a UFO? Was it a classified, dark and disturbing military experiment? We may never know. If it was the latter and the government destroyed all the evidence because it wasn't necessarily needed to be kept, we might never know.
Yeah.
Maybe the government of today doesn't really know. The only way the government would know was if aliens did crash, because that material evidence would never be destroyed. It would be so precious and valuable. So that's really possibly the only chance you have of solving it. And
if it really is what people want it to be.
Well, and if it isn't, there may be nothing other than old memories,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah. What was I going to ask you? The disclosure thing. I bring this up every once in a while on the show, or somebody, one of the guests brings it up. And either that or they ask me, and I say, I think that the disclosure thing is a bunch of people that want to hear what they want to hear. Mm. Not what the government would actually say if they said something about whatever the UFO subject is.
Well, my view on the disclosure movement is that the people in it are, they have the right approach. They're enthusiastic, they're energized, they're galvanized into doing stuff to try and get a response from the government to reveal stuff. But equally, I think it's highly and incredibly naive to imagine that if you shout loudly at the government and demand something, that for some weird reason the government's actually going to listen and do something in response to your demand. You know, governments don't listen and do what people demand. They basically do what they want to do and demand we pay our taxes.
Yeah,
you know, that's how it works, unfortunately.
Yeah, but the they is this collective that has kind of a twisted view of what's going on, because there's not a single idea of what should be going on. It's more like hold on to the power.
Yeah, and here's the other thing, you know, with disclosure. What if the government was to say, okay, we've got all these petitions, we've got 5 million petitions, we're going to reveal the truth. The truth is, we've got a lot of reports. But what crashed at Roswell really was a mogul balloon. The disclosure movement will then say, well, this isn't real disclosure. Why not? Well, because it's not what we expected to hear, so it can't be real disclosure.
Yeah.
So in other words, disclosure will only be accepted
if it's what people want to hear.
Yeah. If it's something else, it's not real disclosure.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like a pointless act, unless the government says what the disclosure movement wants to hear. It's still not the full story. And on top of that, you've got the angle that, you know, one of the reasons why, even if the government has contemplated disclosing what it knows, let's say, hypothetically, the government does have crashed UFOs and dead bodies and, you know, the whole thing, and they decide to reveal that. Well, all that really does is tell us the government has got wreckage, it's got biological remains, and it knows somebody's visited us. It may actually not know more anything other than that. You know, because you have the wreckage of a vehicle from 65 years ago and five bodies or four bodies, that tells you nothing about their modus operandi, where they're from, or anything. And if there's been no open contact and people start asking questions, well, where are they from? What do they want? What about abductions? And the government's like, we don't know, we don't know, we don't know, we don't know. All we've got is just this one craft and these few bodies stored away in this particular underground insulation, and that's all we've got.
Yeah.
Then that opens the door to the idea that, well, maybe the government may not know much, but worse still, they're ignorant of what's going on.
Yeah, and they don't know what to do.
Yeah, and the government will not want to admit their ignorance as much as they don't want to admit that they might have a hell of a lot of material. You know, you can look at it both ways. And I think a lot of people in the disclosure movement have more of a black and white approach. The government's hiding the fact that aliens exist, and we want to know. That's the way they look at it.
Yeah, and they're hiding evidence of free energy, which will help that's the other part of the movement. Yeah. Free energy will help the world be not dependent on fossil fuels, etc.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people in that field haven't given much thought to the idea of what if the government does disclose, and it's not what you want to hear. You know, we'll be back to phase one, because they'll say, well, yeah, like I said before, it's not real disclosure.
Yeah. The point, I had Grant Cameron on my show a while back, and I think I'll have him on again. He did a real good analysis of the Falcon thing, actually.
Oh, cool.
If you read it, go to Presidential UFO and you can read that.
Okay.
PresidentialUFO.com. His point, and that's the title of the interview, was Disclosure Has Already Happened. His point is, how many more indications do you need? Well, we get helicopters here, not sirens. How many more indications you need that the government is interested in UFOs and has some sort of files on them, and that there's people in the government that have been interested in it for a long time? You don't need any more proof of that.
Well, no, but that doesn't tell you anything about the nature of the phenomenon. It doesn't tell, because people are interested, doesn't necessarily equate with people have all the answers.
Well, he's saying, well, his point was disclosures already happened because we know. We're fairly certain to a fairly good degree that, yes, there are people in government that know about the UFO subject. Yes, they are interested in it. Yes, there are records on it. But they're not going to say what the disclosure movement people want them to say. They're going to say, we know this is here. We know it's a problem. We don't know anything. We don't know what it comes from or what to do about it. That's it.
Well, that might well be the case even, you know. But the problem is much of the disclosure movement doesn't believe that. And they don't want to hear that. You know, it very much, you know, a lot of people, ironically, a lot of people put faith in the government hiding all the truth because it makes them think there's a chance of getting the truth. You see what I mean? It's like if the government's sitting on the truth, at least you have a chance of finding it. If the government has nothing more than us, accepts, you know, 30, 40 times as many filing cabinets as the rest of us have, you know,
yeah,
then that's not going to help finding the answer. It's just going to add more reports.
Right.
And so a lot of people do hope the government's sitting on the truth, because if we can't find it, well, at least the government can tell us, you know.
Yeah.
But what, in a worst-case scenario, maybe the government doesn't know, you know, and yeah, that's the reason for the silence.
Well, I think that is the worst. I mean, that's the most likely scenario, not knowing what to do about it.
And I don't think saying that they don't know means that they deny there's a phenomenon.
No, not at all.
Do know there's a real phenomenon, but they just, it doesn't act in the way that you would expect nuts and bolts aliens to act. It's, you know, it's far stranger. So.
Yeah. Hey, Nick, we've been on for over 2 hours, which is longer than normal show, but we can do whatever we want because we're doing this from a remote location.
Control of the airwaves.
Yes, in about an hour, we get to see what the Mars, the Curiosity rover does. Nick, do you want to keep going, or do you kind of burn?
No,
out?
Can I just go and burn? Is there anything to drink out the fridge, like any juice or anything?
Go look.
Okay, cool.
Nick's gonna go look. I want to actually, Miles, if you're listening to us and you want us to give the stream back, please message me or call me or whatever you'd like to do, and we will give the stream back. And we've gone 40 minutes over what we thought we were going to. Because we don't want to drive down to the Griffith Observatory and be stuck in a traffic jam while this historic thing happens. No, I'm fine, thank you.
I'm just dehydrated a bit and dry.
Oh, okay. Oh, good, you got one of the
the San Pellegrino Aranciata Rossa, blood orange soda.
Mm. But yeah, no, I'm quite happy to waffle on. I don't care.
Waffle?
Waffle. It's an English term for...
Yes, I know.
Talk.
Yeah. Oh, really? Here it means you're kind of... muffing about and don't know exactly what you want to say, and you're going back.
Well, it's kind of a little bit like that, but it's also just keep going and going. So.
But you can't pancake on, you have to waffle on. French toast on?
I guess so. But yeah, I don't care. I mean, whatever, if people got any questions or.
Yeah, if you. I will check the Radio Misterioso email, which is linked at the Radio Misterioso site, and if you have a. Connect with me on Facebook. Yeah, right into Nick with some questions. I don't want to talk about gun control, really. Although I know that Nick goes out and does target shooting. I was going to ask if you wanted to go target shooting while you're here. But it's indoors and it's kind of creepy.
Oh, yeah, it's not much fun. But no, I mean, I enjoy target practice. I mean, there's different situations. The thing I could say about gun control, you know, coming from Britain and now living in the US, there isn't much gun crime in Britain. But that's because gun control is so tight that even the criminals have a hard time getting guns. But over here, you couldn't just ban people owning guns because the criminals here have already got the guns.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like if you have open...
What are you, some kind of NRA wacko, Nick?
It's kind of like...
You did live in Texas.
You know, it's kind of like if you ban people owning guns, well, the criminals aren't going to give theirs up. Which makes the situation even more precarious.
Yes.
But if you're...
Well, then the cops will have the guns, right?
Well, yeah, but then if you're in a country where nobody's got guns, it's easier. And I think the big difference between America and Britain in terms of guns is that in America, guns are glamorized.
Yes.
In England...
People just don't even talk about
people
it.
People don't talk... It's not relevant to society, because yeah. Even the cops have to... At the police station, you have to get permission to get the guns out of the safe.
Yeah.
You know, they don't carry guns. Yeah. Unless it's like security police, you know, at the airports and that sort of thing.
Oh, I see,
the average
yeah.
policeman doesn't even carry a gun. But there isn't this sort of romantic idea of, check out this gun, you know, it's cool or whatever. You know, it's just a gun, you know.
Yeah.
So. But that's, I mean, in fairness, I'm not an expert on guns other than the fact that occasionally I fire them, you know, but in terms of society using them, you know, there's all sorts of arguments. I think the one angle that should be kind of played down and not kind of provoked is, you know, the idea that it's cool to have 45 guns hanging on your wall. And
but Nick, you live in Texas.
Well, it don't mean nothing.
The funny thing is, I know, like, you know, peace and love people from Texas, and they have guns. It's just the culture there. I wonder what the crime rate is like. Well, you know what, you can't. It's the culture there is different than the culture in other places in the country.
Yeah, I don't think you can judge one state or even one country compared to another. I just think the fact is that the less guns there are in the world, the less people get killed. It's that simple.
Yeah.
And cultures and societies that ban guns have less murders through
yes.
guns. You know.
And how long would it take to do that here? Probably.
You couldn't do it. Because
yeah. There's just too many out there.
Because the criminals would never give them up. And the average member of the public wouldn't, because they'd be fearful if they give theirs up and the criminals don't. They're going to get shot, so it's a no-win situation, unfortunately.
Adam Gorightly writes in and says, does Nick think that trepanation should be part of the National Health Plan?
I think, well, the big problem is I don't think there's going to be any sort of national... I mean, that's something else I could go into, but I mean, that's nothing to do with UFOs, you know.
What other places are you writing for? What kind of stuff? Because as people may or may not know, Nick actually makes his living on writing.
Well,
unlike a lot of people that are, you know, I don't make my living on writing. No, most people I know don't. So Nick is like kind of a special case. And he treats it as a job.
Well, I mean, it's one of these situations where I don't earn a living from paranormal writing. I earn a living as a writer. I mean, you know, I work for a company in England called E. Howe, which is basically
That sounds Chinese.
Okay, just a little bit.
E how?
the letter E. How?
H-O-W.
Yeah. And E-how? It's basically, you know, I do articles on everything, how to build, you know, fish ponds.
Nick, you know how to build fish ponds?
Yeah, I've had fish ponds all my life, yeah. Greenhouses, avoid sunstroke, hangovers. It's sort of like how tips...
I know how you can avoid sunstroke. Don't take a don't ride in, a, in an air-conditioned van from Albuquerque to Roswell.
That's true, yes. I also do a lot of feature writing for Penthouse magazine. A lot of that, of course, is nothing to do with paranormal, but I have done... A lot of the stuff I do for Penthouse is paranormal as well, like paranormal sex-related articles. I did a big one for them about stuff like incubus-type stories. Yeah. I did one recently about how...
They pay quite well.
Yeah. And I did one just recently about the guy, Dennis Hoff, who has the brothel in Nevada, which is the cat house show on TV. Well, he's just set up a new... Area 51 alien-themed cat house. So I did an article on that.
Oh, okay.
And I've just done... I do a lot of things like that. I also do a lot of sort of contract research for authors and ghost writing. And just general, you know, just whatever freelance writing comes along. Because if you're... You know, freelance writing is a very precarious
job. It's a tough
job. It's a very tough world. And it's sort of like a make or break situation where you have to be really plugged in and network with people and find work. Work's not, unless you're really lucky, work doesn't come to you on a plate. And you have to, it's like any job. There are aspects of your job you enjoy. Others, it's just a job. I enjoy the paranormal writing.
Yeah.
You know, do I get enthused if I have to write a book, write an article about the latest developments in solar energy? No. But that if I'm hired or contracted to write an article on that, you know, that's what I have to do. So
I don't have any more questions.
Well, I don't have any questions as such.
You don't? Don't you want to ask me questions?
Oh, yeah, that's okay. Yeah, we'll ask you some questions because you're the host. You're normally the one who's asking the questions.
Yes.
Okay.
Bill Moore came on once and asked me questions. That was the show, him interviewing me.
Oh, that would be a good one.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Yeah, I mean, actually, there are some questions, you know, that I could ask you. Oh, well, I will ask you. I think, for me at least...
It better not be about strawberry jam.
No, it's not going to be about strawberry
or
jam.
Or marmalade.
Or mammoth books or anything like that.
Mammoths.
But, no, I mean, one of the questions that I would actually ask you, you know, because you've written about this, is what do you really think is going on at Dulcie? I mean, is something going on? Is everything going on? Is nothing going on? Or is something, but it's totally different to what we think, or whatever?
I think something was going on there. There's evidence that there is an underground facility there. Some evidence, I don't know about conclusive. Why are there underground facilities? Because either a private company or the government or a combination of the two doesn't want somebody to be able to see what's going on, either on the ground or from satellites or the air. What do they want to hide? Usually defense-related. Mm. So, you know, what could be defense-related up in that area? Or maybe even, you know, considering all the cattle mutilations and all the things going up there... maybe what some people think, some sort of biological facility that's sealed underground, so it's not as easy to get, you know, it's harder to get those things out into the environment. Mm. Maybe that's what was going on. And the thing to do when you have something going on is if you think people know where this facility is, you start leaking out to people that there's a facility there, and then you see who comes looking. And you tell them the stealth fighter crashed once near Bakersfield. Some people knew about it, so it was carefully leaked to the press that the thing had crashed in a certain place, and they gave sort of a vague location of where it was. It was 10-15 miles away from the crash actually happened. So people all came running over there. Whoever had heard about it, they could see who came running over there, what they were doing, who they were looking for, and who they communicated with.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the same thing that went on with Dulcie as a base, is that somebody leaked out sometime in the 19th, you know, Paul Benowitz, around the time of Paul Benowitz,
somebody decided that it would be good for him to know about some sort of facility up there. Maybe somebody already knew about it, like some Russian agent said, oh, well, there's a facility here. And they leaked that information to the Russian agent or whatever the agent was by having Paul Benowitz talk about it. Because he was in communication, I believe, with some UFO, so supposedly UFO researchers from around the world, including possibly the Soviet Union. And they allowed those to happen because they wanted those people to keep communicating with Benowitz so they could feed them crap and also possibly see who they were. So by drawing his attention there, basically to the wrong area, they could have somebody come up there and not compromise the integrity of whatever facility might be there. Now, I think it's probably gone now or not being used now. And I have a lead from somebody who says that he did not work there, but he knew people that either had worked there or there was a rumor that there was some sort of underground facility there because he claims to have worked in underground facilities. Like he'd take an elevator down, they'd take some kind of transport somewhere, they wouldn't know where they were going, but it was a long distance because the things went really fast, and they'd do their work and then they'd come back to where the elevator was somewhere in New Mexico and take the elevator back up to the surface. They didn't know how far down they went, how far they went, or anything like that. But yeah, I think there is something there. It used to be used as something else, and that's as far as I know. And this is just basically assumptions based on what a lot of things people have told me, most of which I haven't talked about. Yeah, there's also involving research into the geological history of the area, earthquakes in the area, stuff like that.
Okay. One other question, sort of if time and funding, etc., unlimited, what sort of, which would be your sort of pet case that you'd really want to sort of pursue to its ultimate end, you know, whether a book or just to get the answer? I mean, is there sort of one case or one aspect of the UFO phenomenon that you would really sort of like to nail to the wall as to what it is, you know, an event or, you know, an aspect of the subject or something?
I guess it'd have to involve something I think that there's enough information on. It's not really any particular case that I'm interested in. What I'd like to do is make people more aware of other aspects of UFO. People outside the field, people that are like not really invested into the invested heavily in the subject matter. Let them realize, and people from the outside realize, that they don't have to think about aliens when they think about UFO. And you and I and a lot of people, we know that's an old theme with us. But outside of the field, that's nobody even thinks about that. And I would like to be basically cheerlead that stuff so that people realize, you know, and people are doing this. Paul's writing a new book like that. Micah Hanks has done this. His book's about to be published. And I don't know, maybe I can't really contribute anything to it, but I would like to. I would also like to possibly, your big suggestion, which resonates with me, do something about the Dulce Base and the history of it and what, you know, is there any, you know, get to the bottom of that story. And I know that was a bit of a leading question, but I answered another part of it first. But those are the two main things. The Dulce thing, I think, that whole mythos. The whole underground base thing, how it connects with the cattle mutilation thing, how it connects with the culture up there, how it connects with the politics there, how it connects with mineral rights, the Los Alamos labs, all kinds of stuff that's been going on there for probably 40 years or more. That would probably, and I'm sort of actually working on that. I'll be out in New Mexico at the end of the month looking up people and talking to people about that again, actually, to see if there's a story there. If there's no story there and I don't think I can pull anything out of it, I probably won't do it. But I didn't say, I'm going to write a book. What I said was, if I can find enough evidence to justify writing more, I will do it.
Okay. I know one of your other areas of interest is alien writing. Can you talk a little bit about how and why you got interested in that?
Well, you know how I got interested in it.
Well, I do. I know part of the story, at least.
There was a researcher named Mario Pozzaglini. He was a clinical psychologist. He worked with heavily drug-addicted and disturbed teenagers. But his side interest was alien writing, and I found out later it's because he'd been channeling it since he was a kid. He wouldn't admit that to me right away. It took about a year and a half to 2 years of talking to him and getting it in confidence where he finally said, that was me. The person I talked about in the interview,
And it's just interesting to me how, not if this kind of stuff comes from aliens, but how the human brain would interact with something that's not human through the medium of writing.
Okay.
And there's many examples of it from different cultures. And the example Mauro had was angelic music, he said. But it looked like basically a bunch of X's and O's and lines with circles at the ends of them. There's a, and I talked with names are dropping off my head right now, but there's a branch of art called acemic writing, which is basically where people create things that look like writing but aren't.
Okay.
As abstract art.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I was turned on to this by Mac Tony's site.
Mm-hmm.
Or either that, or he told me, and I did a whole post on it, and we talked about it on the show that he was on, and about what the significance might be. And there, you know, I think there are a few genuine examples of quote unquote alien writing. The ones that I think, and I took this from Mario, that tend to be the ones that are more true or genuine, or whatever you want to call it, are the ones that don't have a one-to-one relationship to the language of the percipient, like the India to the Planet Mars book.
Oh yeah,
mm-hmm. That by this woman whose name I can't remember. It was Helene something. That wasn't her real name. A French woman. She said that she had been born on Mars and she was a queen. She was the queen of Mars or something like that, and she developed this whole language. It just happened to have a one relationship with French.
Mm-hmm.
Her native language. It could be translated in a one-to-one relationship basis. And that, if you think about it a little more, you would think, well, if something was trying to communicate with us, would it not translate a concept in our mind into something that we could understand like English? So maybe I've softened up a bit on that one.
Okay.
But, you know, where does that leave you? It really doesn't leave you with anything. It's just an interesting thing, like a piece of artwork to me. And just like channeling, just like abduction stuff, just like contactees, there's examples of people communicating with, possible examples of people communicating with something that's not human, and how does that interaction take shape? That's what interests me.
Okay. One other question I got, not so much how the phenomenon might develop in the years ahead or our perceptions of it, how do you sort of perceive trend-wise that the UFO community is going to change, modify, develop, fall by the wayside or whatever, you know, in the years ahead? I mean, are we kind of going to see something, you know, similar to the economy going down the drain? You know, are we going to see droppers in conference levels, magazines closing because of the internet, etc.? And does that mean, you know, that things are going to change? To get your sort of views on ufology, the future of ufology, rather than the future of UFO research.
I'd like yours, too.
You'd like my what?
You view on the same thing. We have five minutes.
Oh, okay, cool.
You go first. You're the guest. Then I'll try and shorten mine out.
Okay,
the future of ufology. What do you think is going to happen? What do you think should happen?
I think what should happen is that people didn't get bogged down by a particular theory. I think what is happening is it's becoming more about entertainment and maintaining a kind of image, if you like, and different people, this person believes that.
Yeah.
And it's becoming, you know, more along those lines rather than an open debate on a definitive unknown. And I think it needs to get back to that and away from the idea that, you know, these are the superstars of ufology, you know, and just get it on a research level again.
Yeah. But what do you think is going to happen?
Oh, I think it'll pretty much go on as it is. I think, you know, you'll have the debunkers, the nuts and bolts believers. You'll have X number of conferences per year talking about old cases and a few new ones. But there won't really be any major significant discoveries. It'll always be just on the horizon, but we'll never get past the horizon.
Yeah, I kind of think that too. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I think the way that it, and I've whined about this before, and people get mad. My first point in how to change things, because I would come up and say, you know, UFOs aren't from other planets, possibly, but how can we change this instead of just whining about it? And my first one was get rid of the big UFO groups.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Number one, get rid of MUFON, get rid of QFOs, get rid of any other vaguely large UFO group, mm-hmm. and replace them with small groups that communicate across the internet.
Mm-hmm.
That way, there's not, you know, you've got 15 different dogmas instead of one or mm-hmm. two. And I'd like to have 15 or 20 or 30 different dogmas, because then, you know, you've got people coming at the problem from many, many different disciplines. And mm-hmm. And maybe one of them would, you know, and hopefully, because this is never going to happen, try to be non-dogmatic about it and see if they can, you know, get something from each other's research. Mm-hmm. Like, these people are doing DMT research, and mm-hmm. these people are doing abduction research, and these are... You know, and that was my next one. Get rid of abduction research in the mm-hmm. form that it is now. No more, like you said, no more superstars, mm-hmm. nothing like that. Like, you know, like something like Yvonne Smith does, or, mm-hmm. or Barbara Lamb. Mm-hmm. Have a small group, communicate privately about what's going on. No big, you know, TV shows, no big books, anything like that. And I bet you anything, if the things could be diffused like that, that you would see some changes. Mm-hmm. They wouldn't be big ones. They wouldn't be earth-shattering, but it'd be a lot more interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And there might be a breakthrough there. I don't know.
Okay.
You know, that's the way I think that things could change. And I would like to see them change. I don't think that's going to happen, because people like centralized big things. Mm-hmm. It seems impressive to them. Mm-hmm. But, you know, since the internet started happening and most people have an internet connection, I see no reason to have giant UFO organizations anymore.
No, you're right.
Unless they're, you know, connected up on the internet, I guess. But anyway, but either that or just, you know... People start up your own groups, and you know everybody's going to be dogmatic and all mm. like that. But you know, use the medium of the internet to communicate your findings to people, and to diffuse them through more people, and to make the whole process more democratic. I think mm. instead of having somebody at the top of an organization saying this is the way we're going to do things, this is our idea about things, our spokesman says this.
Mm-hmm.
I think that era should be done with at this point. Mm-hmm. There's no reason for it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right, cool.
We're at 10 o'clock, and we have to give Miles his feedback.
All righty, cool.
His live streaming feed.
Okay.
Not feedback. Oh, say hi to Nick for me, says Ken Thomas.
Okay. Hey, Ken.
I am going to... Thanks so much, Nick.
All right. Well, thanks for having me on the show.
Yeah. Now we're going to watch the rover possibly land on the planet. I wonder if they're taking bets in Vegas, I asked Nick. What's your new book?
Pyramids in the Pentagon.
You had to think for a second. What's the newest one?
It's out now, anyway.
And it's out now, yes, on Amazon and
New Barnes Page. Barnes & Noble.
New Page published
it. New Page Books, yeah.
Yeah. So we're going to wait for it to see what lay odds on the Curiosity rover and see what happens here in about half an hour. And next week, I don't know who's on. I'm going to interview Scott Corrales by phone this week.
Oh, cool.
So I don't know if we're going to post that before this next Saturday or in place of next Saturday. But Scott Corrales will be, you know, Institute of Hispanic Ufology will be on my guest next time. And it will not be live. I'm going to pre-record that. So thanks for listening. It's Radio Misterioso. We'll be back maybe even before next week. And no, not Cockeyed Ballot again. How about the fall of the late the fall of the planet Earth by the Moonbillies, who also did the Left Planet.
Ladies and gentlemen.
Once again, thanks for listening.
London Observatory.
Adios.
From somewhere in outer space.
What did you say? Oh, I thought you said up yours.
Presenting the Moonbillies.
It was said so sad, it was tan so bad. The fall of the great planet Earth.
Now come all you space creatures and listen to our song. A story of the mighty Earth and what they did so wrong. They hung there in outer space, they were our closest friend. Until they built their atom bomb, and then it was their end.
Yes, man, it was bad, so bad. The fall of that great planet Earth.
We watched them in our telescopes. They had such funny ways. They drove around in gas machines on things they call freeways. Their women, they were pretty. Their men were brave and true. But they wouldn't trust each other. And now their world is through.
It was sad, so sad. It was bad, so bad. The fall of the great planet Earth.
We tried so hard to warn them, but heed they would not take. We sent our spaceships down to them, but they were called a fake. Oh, how sad their ending, their doom we could not stop. They built their bombs and rockets, and then they blew their top.
It was sad, so sad, it was bad, so bad. The fall of that great planet Earth.
Oh, if there is another world a-listening to this song, please take our advice to you and stop the ways of wrong. Build your world on trust and love and not on fear and hate. And take a lesson from the earth and do not share their fate.
It was sad, so sad, it was bad.